Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to Action Radio. This is Greg Penglis coming to you from the historic district of downtown Milton on the banks of the beautiful Blackwater River. And now let's get into Action Radio.
You know, I was just thinking that for most of my life, Monday morning's been a pain. It's like, oh, God, I got to go to work, or oh, God, I've got to go to school. And now it's like, oh, boy, I get to do radio. It's just such a totally different idea. You've got to just follow your passion. You've got to do what you love doing. Otherwise, it's just going to be miserable. It's just really no fun. So I understand the Monday drudgery, but for me, it's just fun. It is like playtime. And so things are pretty cool. I have what I think is going to be a fascinating show. We've got Shannon Rice. Haven't heard from Shannon in way too long. She's up right now on deck. And I've got a topic for you. Well, a lot of this has been geared around the truckers. And so we did last week's show with Dr. Roger Roots, who's a professor, who's a lawyer. And we talked about how all the Western land out in the left half of the country, that land is actually state land, not federal land. The feds were never entitled to keep it. They just did after the territories where they had, land became states, and they just kept the land like it was still a territory. We also proved that carbon dioxide is a wonderful thing, that we could have 10 times the amount of carbon dioxide in the air and be just fine. We got about 350 parts per million carbon dioxide. Submarines don't consider it, dangerous until 8,000 parts per million. So that's a huge difference. So we could easily have, like I say, 2,000, 3,000 parts per million, and we'd be just fine. And the plants would love it. The Sahara would be, it'd look like a rainforest. So, all these things. And today, excuse me, oh, still the last little remnants of my cold. And today we're going to show that oil is, in fact, a renewable resource, that it's not just a fossil fuel. Well, it might be some fossil remnants in there somewhere, but for the most part, the Earth makes oil. I mean, it just does. And what's so fascinating about this is that all the scientists around this are kind of centered in the Russian-Ukraine area. Gee, what a coincidence, because we'll be looking into that, too, whether Burisma, Hunter Biden, was actually working on what they call abiotic oil as opposed to biotic, in other words, biological oil. This is non-biological oil, which makes a lot more sense to me. We're going to talk about that too. But anyway, we haven't heard from Shannon for a while, so let me play this theme. I don't even know if it's still accurate. We'll find out in a minute, but let's get going here.
She served her country in the Air Force. She swore to support and defend the Constitution of the United States. And now Shannon Rice serves on the City Council of Milton, Florida. One voice, unwavering, still supporting and defending the Constitution against a wave of emergency declarations, lockdowns, and unlawful force. And all in support of the rights of her constituents and all Americans. She is Shannon Rice, and this is the Rice Report.
Okay, let's get
the
record
Greg.
Straight.
Good morning.
Are you still in the city council or not? Or is that what's the deal there? Am I still accurate or
yes,
no?
I'm still in the city council, and I thought you were asking if it was accurate if I still support and defend the Constitution. And
oh, of course not. I know you do that. No, I know you do that. But because we haven't talked for a while, so I wasn't sure if you're still on the council. Because when you're not here each week, I don't get the council info, and I don't because I do so much with state and national, international issues that I really depend on folks like you that know local issues to kind of keep me on board there. I got Pianki in the line too. Pianki, I'm just going to hold you off for a little bit. We're going to talk some local stuff here, and then I'll bring you on once we get into this a little bit, because you might have an opinion on this as well. But how you been? What's going on? What do you got for us? The Rice Report continues. This is so exciting. Actually, let me give you a round of applause here. Wait a minute. Don't go away. Let me see if I can find my faster and faster. No, this is fun. Oh, I got the gong here, too. I haven't played that. No, I'll save the gong. Here we go. Here's your cheer. Yay, she's back. Welcome back
Thank
to
you.
Action Radio. Yeah.
So because of your question there, if it was still accurate, you had me thinking when you were playing the intro there. Since I last spoke to you, we had a vote. I brought up a vote to support medical freedom
okay,
in
good.
The city, that we would do that. So that passed. And then we got half the rollback rate for the millage rate, which was to lower our property taxes in the city.
Excellent.
And that was quite a negotiation. I introduced that I wanted the full rollback and couldn't get enough support to get it. I have one council member vote with me, but that wasn't enough to get it through. But we held them up because it takes a supermajority vote of the council, and they couldn't get it because two of us were holding out and we had one or two members that were absent. So I was able to negotiate for half a rollback rate, which is something.
What's millage?
Still fighting for low taxes.
Oh, no. Hey, listen, anything you do with low taxes is a good thing. So for folks that don't know around the country that have different systems, what's millage?
Millage just means the property tax rate, which would be the percentage of property tax. So it just lowered it a little bit. We don't have a high one here, but I'm just always fighting to get it a little bit lower. As the city grows, it seems that taxes go up, but it makes sense that taxes would go down because there's more people paying in. But, you know, as government grows, like we don't want it to, it goes up.
Well, because they think of more things to do. Is that, well, we got more people. We got more money. Let's go spend it somewhere. It's like, no, you're missing the point of how this is supposed to work, folks. This is why I'm glad you're on the city council, you know, as opposed to a bunch of other folks who just happily spend the money and, you know, find their pet projects and line their pockets and do what politicians usually do. And those folks don't come on the show for obvious reasons. Yeah, exactly.
Let's see what else. Bands on the Blackwater is going to be starting up April 1st. I know you're a fan of Bands on the Blackwater.
Yes. Wait, who wants to be the first band on April 1st? The April Fool's the Band on the Blackwater. Yeah. For those who don't know, let me paint a little picture for people here. We had this amazing thing. It happens twice a year. It happens in the spring. It happens in the fall. And it's like bug season. when it gets warm and the bugs come out, it's like time for Bands on the Blackwater. So we had this wonderful wide open space in Milton right by the Blackwater River. And they've lined it with these white lights. It looks like a big festival park. And they have a stage. And then there's a couple of different places. They keep moving around. But we get food trucks. We get just all kinds of folks dropping in. And it's a real family affair. It's a real party. And some pretty decent bands have come through there. And so it's free concert. And, of course, all the town things benefit afterwards, too. You can go to, like, Gulf Coast Garage, you know, and, Brew Angels, you know, for brew pubs. And they're across the street from each other, so you can, you know, try the different wares. See, we got Boomerang's Restaurant. We got, you know, Blackwater Bistro. I think K&B Cafe is open late, too. And as we get more and more of these wonderful businesses in town, I'm hoping to turn the courthouse into Courthouse Marketplace, you know, kind of like a Pike Place Seattle, only on a smaller scale. There's just so much going on here. But Bands on the Blackwater, you know, really brings a lot of people in. And it's very cool. It's a lot of fun. I mean, where do you get a free concert on a riverbank? You know, with just a whole bunch of people, all your friends kind of hanging out. So that's why I like it.
Yes, yeah. It's a draw. And let's see, what else can I tell you about? I'm trying to stay positive here because I've got some, there's always some frustration with the government and being on the council. Most recent is we have a council member that doesn't show up for meetings.
Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
Well, it's bad because the council members are supposed to represent their constituents. So even if it was a person that I didn't agree with, they should still show up for meetings because
they
that's
should
what
still
they
show.
Were
then you outvote elected. Them. Yeah, that's okay. Yeah, I can handle that. But, yeah.
Well, you know, yes, if they don't show, they don't get a vote. But you know. We're representative democracy. They're supposed to show. That's how the people get their say. Is they
did you say democracy?
Representative in there? And
did you say democracy
that?
On my show? You said democracy.
I did. Well, I said representative democracy.
You mean republic? That's like saying Biden is president. I mean, you might as well just swear at me. I mean, come on.
No. I'm saying the way we do government is we elect our representatives.
Right,
so,
that's a republic.
And that's what's that?
Well, it's a republic because you have rules and you have constitutional rights and things like that. That's a republic. Democracy is just like, you know, it's like a free for all, whatever you want. You know, majority rules. Okay. Fine.
No, I understand that, and I know that the country is is not a democracy. I'm not talking about that. I'm saying the way we get our officials in office. So
right.
We elect our.
No, I'm just.
We elect,
I'm just teasing you.
We
though.
Elect the people. Oh, are you?
Well, it's not your fault. So, it's just that I've heard the word democracy too many times, you know, over the course of the weekend. And every time I do, I want to throw things because we're not a democracy. We're a republic. You know, Article 4, Section 4 yes. clearly states that we are guaranteed a Republican form of government, not a Republican party because
okay,
they're
yes.
a bunch of geldings,
okay.
but an actual republic, you know, of rights and laws and rules of evidence at trial and,
right.
the, you know, due process and all those kind of things, you know. But
yes.
so whenever
hold,
I hear democracy,
wait a minute.
Go ahead,
so,
back up. Your
I'm
turn.
Just saying how we get our officials in office is they're elected, and then they're to represent the people so that we don't have
yeah.
to vote on as the community,
right.
we don't have to vote on every single item.
I understand that. No, I'm just lashing out at the word democracy. It's
so I know.
Like
I get
say,
it now.
It's,
that's
it's,
your.
Yeah.
Don't say that word around Greg.
Don't say that word. Yeah. The other one is you can't say President Biden because it's when I throw my computer and the whole
okay.
show's over. You know, and so they're just
okay,
things you just. I'm going to get. I'm not picking on you. I'm just deciding. I think I've decided to get a little more adamant about certain things. You know, it's the Brandon insurrection. That's approved language here. You know, and the other one you can't say as of today is fossil fuel. You can't say fossil fuel. You just can't. There's no
okay,
such thing.
I won't.
You know, we're not going to get much of. We're not going to drill into rocks and get those little white bones and try and create enough fuel to run a 747. It just ain't going to happen. So we're not going to talk fossil fuels either. It's just that. You know what it was? I got sleep last night. I'm feeling good. This is a dangerous situation. Anyway.
So we have a council member that doesn't show up. So I don't like it.
Yeah.
And there is an election coming up. So if the
mm-hmm.
person would go ahead and step down. Then we could get it on the ballot. If
ooh,
they
nice.
Don't step down, I mm-hmm. have a pretty strong opinion about that. If they don't step down until it's too late on the ballot, then my opinion is that it's the same as a stolen election because they have stolen the vote from the people. And so we have a bit of contention right now on the council about
yeah.
that
okay.
because I'm not standing well, for it because the people should vote in their officials. If the people do not vote in officials on our council, then they're appointed, and they're appointed by the council. I don't like it.
No, actually, this makes a lot of sense. And if you want to, since people on the city council are public officials, you can name them. You know, I just like to keep private people private. But if they're a public official, they're fair game. So you can say who it is. And if you think they're stealing the election and you want to just state so publicly, I mean, you feel free. You don't have to. But I'm just saying, I don't mind,
well,
you know, public officials being told
them
for what they're doing. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm not
go
accusing
ahead.
Them of stealing it yet. But if we
okay.
wait too long, it will have been.
Okay.
To get it on the ballot, it has to be in by August. But it wouldn't be right to wait till the last minute because people need to know that seat's going to be open. So and make their choices if they're going to run for that seat.
So if they
or not.
Don't, let me just to clarify here. So if they hang onto the seat and then to decide to run or not run very late, it'd be too late for someone else to run. So they're actually holding it, you know, until someone can get appointed rather than elected. Is that because that would be scandalous?
Well,
that would suck.
It would be. It would be if yeah. that's what's happening. And that's what I said in the meeting. Is I said this is going to look like this if they don't step down soon.
Okay.
And I don't want any part of that. So person needs to make their decision if they're going to continue to serve. And what it is they were elected in the last cycle, and it's a four-year term. So they would have 2 years left if they continue to serve. But they're not really serving now because they don't show up for the meetings or enough of the meetings. They show up for the minimum by the charter that they wouldn't automatically be put out of office, but it's very few meetings.
Do they
so,
do real estate on the side? I'm just checking because that's a big deal. Are they friends with large housing developers?
No, I don't know about that.
Okay, just curious. Those are the big ones around here because we are growing fast.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I don't know anything about as far as that. I
uh-huh.
just, you know, you're elected by the people to represent them, and you can't represent them if you're not at the meetings. And
yeah.
that's where I stand on it. And it really is not a matter of me winning a vote or getting my way on the council because I don't know which way this person would vote every time. It's that
mm-hmm.
they promised the people that they would represent them. And if our elected officials don't show up, then I think it's a big fail
on
how our government works if the you know, if the people you elect to represent you don't show.
Yeah.
Then
there's Go ahead. Well, I love talking local politics because, you know, this happens in every town, all across the country. And so it's we're definitely a microcosm, but I think we're a little more activists here and more conservative and more pro-constitution, and hopefully that'll rub off on a lot of other places. Pianchi, I made your line live to see if you want to join us for the discussion with Shannon, or were you more interested in waiting a bit until we start talking renewable oil?
I was going to ask Shannon. She's on the school board. Do you know other city? Do you get picked up at your house by a chauffeur limousine like those in New York?
No, we don't. But if it would make this council member show, I would go pick them up and take them to the meeting. I would do it.
Hey,
that's something in New York. The school board members get picked up at their house with a chauffeur limousine. Did you know that?
Oh my goodness.
No, I didn't. No, that's crazy.
Well, especially when you consider they're a bunch of communists. You know, they're destroying the school system. They're still masking kids. You know, they're little dictators. I have no. Oh boy, that's crazy. I think it. Oh wow. They should pick up the parents.
The children up there.
I don't know. Have they stopped? If they've stopped, it's been very recent.
I don't know because we haven't had that here for so long, and you know, city of Milton, we didn't put up with that.
Well, no, you led the charge to make sure that the mayor at the time, is Mayor Lindsay still mayor? Is she still?
She is.
Okay, yeah.
It's
but she
be up for election this year as well.
Okay, well, hopefully we'll have somebody else run against her. She was on the show. She's very nice, you know. But we just disagreed completely on most things, but especially, you know, the man, because you know, and when she says, and I'll never forget this quote. Well, I'm just following the chain of command. Well, you know, the United States government's not a military operation. I'm sorry. I hate to tell you this, but we have constitutional rights and we have due process. And you know, trying to mandate something from the CDC, you know, that's a guideline and a suggestion, it's just not going to work. I mean, it worked in a lot of the country, unfortunately, but at least Milton stood strong. And Shannon, you're part of that to keep these ridiculous mandates out. You know, they're so blatantly unconstitutional. Search and seizure, equal protection. I mean, it's just tons of different, you know, reasons why. Those things, you know, were just horrible. And you can see the results. I mean, the kids, you know, are suffering huge mental problems, physical problems, everything from face rashes to, you know, all kinds of other stuff. Those masks are awful. And so it's nice to not have them. So that's a good thing. I had a question, though, for you on medical freedom, because Cindy Cagle, who's on the show Thursdays, who has a group, Citizens for Medical Freedom, who called in from Washington last week. The state, she was working with the state on a medical freedom bill too. So is that a similar thing? Does it cover different areas? Is there a reason for a Milton medical freedom bill? What's going on with that? That's an interesting issue.
What we did was this was to pass a resolution, which just means where the council stands on something. And the point of it was to say that we support adults making their own choices for their own health. And just getting it out there so that I was hoping that nothing would come forward asking us to do otherwise, and that to put in the sentiment of the area, because, again, as representatives of the people, we should know where the people stand on this and be voting how the people would vote. So this area does support people's right to choose whether or not they're going to get a vaccine or whether they're not going to wear a mask, and you know how they're going to deal with their own health choices. One thing that's coming up very soon is that right now the city of Milton policy is to not hire a person to work for the city if they use tobacco. And a lot of people have very strong feelings about tobacco use, because we know it can hurt your health. However, tobacco use is legal. So I believe that the council is going to overturn that, and we're going to remove that stipulation because it does keep people out of work. And As I brought it up in the meeting where it was first introduced, is, you know, I have make some bad choices when it comes to what I eat.
So, oh, don't we all?
I don't want anyone in my life when it telling me what I can and can't, or mm-hmm. that I can't have a job with the city because of what I weigh. So I can see we should not put those rules on someone that smokes. Smoking is legal. So that should be removed. It's wrong. And yeah. Right now they also charge 5% more on the insurance if a person uses tobacco, and that should be removed as well, as far as I'm concerned, because obesity is not controlled the same way if you work for the city, and there's no extra charge if a person is overweight. And we know that obesity causes problems, but we're not getting in people's personal business with that. So we need to stay out of it with tobacco use as well.
Yeah, here's this is interesting. I want to hop on this for a second because, you know, as someone that was a flight instructor, you know, and had a young kid, the later days of my instructing when I was doing it part time, you can't get life insurance as a flight instructor. Ain't gonna happen, you know. So there's certain things that and private pilots, I think it's like prohibitively expensive. Flight instructors, forget it. You know, you're not going to. So that's why flight instructors should be young and single. Or old and retired, either way. Yeah, I mean, this whole idea of workplace discrimination, this goes to the Michelle Obama, you know, thing that they're going to deny health care if you weigh too much. You know, the question is, where does freedom end? I mean, on the one side, you're going to get the argument, well, it costs us more money collectively as a society, you know, if people don't wear motorcycle helmets and they don't and they weigh more than the statistical, you know, average, you know, biomass thing, which is way too low anyway. And if you engage in things like bungee jumping and you know, flying little airplanes and but that's the stuff that makes life worth living. You know, is that steak and fine wine and, you know, and the crazy adventure and, you know, drag racing your car, you know, that's what makes life fun. So if the socialists, you know, try to outlaw fun, I am full agreement that there are certain people who are going to be more adventurous than others, and that you don't start charging more or requiring different things at work. Yeah, I find tobacco smoke disgusting. My parents smoked. I hated it. You know, I always left the room. But, you know, I wouldn't make it illegal. You know, I just don't want to be in the same room. So smoking is unusual because it affects other people directly. You know, when you're in the same room. So it's like, yes, can you smoke? Sure. Can you smoke around me? No. You know, go outside. I don't care if it's freezing cold.
It's not,
you know,
there's not going to be any smoking in the office or anything like that.
Of course
it's just
not.
That right now, they have to test annually. They would test before they were hired, and they have to
test
annually your analysis. If you have tobacco in your system, then they know it.
Oh, really?
So, yeah.
Oh, so now they're tobacco testing? Oh, that's funny. They're not testing for legal substances. Huh. Are they going to do, you know, biomass next or what? Are they going to, like, get the pictures up, the calipers and, you know, go ahead.
I was going to say, it probably tests for that too, but just the tobacco-free workplace, I think it's just way too intrusive. Now, if you want to encourage it by
well, a workplace, sure,
free to quit.
Yeah, don't smoke at work, but you can't stop someone from smoking at home. You can't tell people what to do if they're not on the job. You know,
right now,
well, see, they can't. Yes, yeah, that's wrong. That's absolutely wrong. Let's see, Pianki, do you have a comment on this? From the middle
of the nation. If you had a national health plan, mm-hmm. if you had national insurance or government paid insurance by a city, then I think you're going to have people to monitor what they do in order to stay healthy. You know, I was listening to a commercial one time where somebody who the doctor had told them not to have certain things, they wouldn't order a pizza.
Mm-hmm.
And when they rung the pizza up, they had to pay a surtax because they had on that pizza what the doctors had told them not to have. They had to pay more, which went toward the insurance premium. So,
how would they know that? Was the restaurant connected with the doctors? How would they know that the person wasn't supposed to have certain things on it? Or they just have
the
a surtax
digital
on
information
all?
On your digital information on your debit cards and other identification.
What? Seriously?
Yeah.
But didn't they, like, outlaw or however they stopped it, the Big Gulp drink somewhere up in New York? The 32
ounce? Yeah, that was Bloomberg.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
I'll tell you something else, too. School districts shouldn't, may want to think about not having contact sports until a child reaches the 10th grade.
Well, I've never been crazy about football for young boys because their bones aren't ready for it. You know, they go crashing each other's big heads and things. You know, it's
that's the way you get back at those liberals in the NFL.
Oh, there you
go.
My
goodness. If we don't play rough when we're young, then you wouldn't want to play rough by the time you're in 10th grade.
No, I didn't say you can play rough.
Third grade.
We used to have wrestling matches when I was a kid in Australia. And that's the first thing I had to do being Canadian. I had to wrestle all the kids in the class so they found out, you know, how strong I was. I mean, it was hysterical. We were very rough. That wasn't the point. I played Australian football, you know, which is like, you know, 10 times faster than American football and you don't have pads. That's a rough game. I mean, we would crash into each other and, you know, we're trying to catch the ball and run with it. And everybody's trying to knock you down and tackle you. Oh, yeah. You know, it's not as bad as rugby. You know, I still have all my teeth. But you know, we played rough and we loved it. It was not a problem. You know, I was very competitive in Australia. We did tennis and I was on the crew team and all kinds of stuff. So it was extremely competitive. But that wasn't the point.
The point was
we didn't have the padding. Football, American football, just to make this one point, American football style play with all those pads and things actually causes far more injuries for young kids and just the nature of the game. It's not being rough. It's football, I think, is, you know, because you don't see these things in baseball or soccer or basketball or any of the other sports we do. It's football. I think that's the problem. Go ahead, Bianchi.
Well, here's the thing. Mm-hmm. I've seen, and we both know, that when students go to school with American flag T-shirts, mm-hmm. okay, a Betsy Ross flag on their whatever, then they are ostracized. And then you got football players that's kneeling. They're wearing on their uniform all these slogans and that. Well, this is what we did. We banned contact sports until a student reaches the 10th grade where their body is more developed and they're able to survive and not be permanently damaged from that type of activity. That's what
What kind of sports are we talking about here? Because how many contact sports are there?
Football.
That's really the main one. You know, like I say, I don't think – I mean, kids actually do get injured in soccer, you know, because you get kicked a lot.
Oh,
you know,
yeah, soccer is fine.
You should see the shin injuries, you know.
Yeah,
wear the shin pads. Yeah, but people fall all the time. You got cleats and everybody's getting – but it's not serious injuries generally. Basketball, people fall on basketball courts all the time.
Your high school football is used as a training ground toward the NFL where you had all that kneeling – you know, all that repulsive things about not wanting to play the national anthem, removing Kate Smith from America the Beautiful. Well, let's not let our children engage in contact sports until we feel that their bodies are able to handle such activity.
Well, let me ask Shannon about that. Is that something you would ever bring up at the city council? Is that something that you'd make a priority?
Well, I
or not.
That,
you don't have to. I'm just, you know,
curious. Football is high school football anyway. I mean, there is the younger divisions, but no, I'm afraid I would be chased out of town. This town loves football, and
it really does. This is a football
town.
I'd
be shunned by my family that love football and kids playing football.
See, the high school's different.
Yeah,
high school,
you think about the health of the kids, man.
You're older.
Kids getting hurt and damaged, neck injury could lead to paralysis. No.
In third grade, I was playing in the woods, climbing trees. Kids can fall out of trees, you know. Mm-hmm. Like I said, jumping off buildings.
I did.
I don't know. I was a rough and tumble kid. I loved my childhood. I wouldn't want to, ever protect children out of not being able to live and have fun. So I'm just very hesitant to put any of those kind of rules in, you know, or I feel uncomfortable talking about it. Can you hear me?
No, it's okay. No, I understand. But and this is a football town. I mean, it really is. And high school, like I say, high school. I mean, I watch football, but when you're talking like 10, 11 year olds, those Pop Warner leagues and things like that. It gets a little too serious. They could play flag ball.
Yeah,
exactly.
Let them put a flag.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that would make perfect sense. And even the little league parents get a little crazy with kids. The parents take it too seriously. They can't play. It's with that fun. Anyway, go ahead, Shannon.
But I think the kids love it.
They love the football? Okay. Well, and see I don't know. So then maybe it's just an issue of disclosure. Saying this can't be, because he wasn't really a friend of mine, but the kid I knew in high school, he did break his neck, literally, and was paralyzed for a while. And then he had this huge contraption he had to wear, this big cage thing on his head. And so everybody's like, whoa, boy, glad you're alive. Yeah, me too. And it was one of those things. And so it happens. He broke his neck. Well, he wasn't paralyzed, but he was immobilized. He had to make sure his head did not move for like months. And so it was a big deal. And so it can be a problem, And like I say, I've never been a great fan of football for that reason. I played in the band, so I watched enough football. And for the most part, everybody was fine, but there were injuries. I mean, there definitely were. So it's I'm not sure what to do about football. Football's, because it is such a tradition and such a, like I say, a big deal, especially in the South. Football in the South is like, it's the game.
Yeah, but when you got the NFL politicizing it along BLM. Yep. And stuff like that. Well, then you got to politicize against them too. And say, until I feel it's safe for their body. You get back to the parent having a control over what their child is engaged in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and they do.
I understand what you're saying, and I completely disagree with what the NFL did, but those were adults that chose whether to stand or whether to kneel. And if an adult is going to succumb to peer pressure, then that's their own personal weakness. So I would say the parent can do good to their child by expressing to them that these, this is what America's all about, and we don't succumb to peer pressure.
But you know what, where it all, your child playing Pop Warner going into high school, they are using that for a training ground for their college, then into the professional.
Well, college is another one, too. I mean, how much money is in college sports and college football? College football brings in millions and millions of dollars to these bigger schools. That's a whole different thing. And they got kids playing football. That's what they're doing in college. I think they should get a free education afterwards. Like, okay, you play 4 years of college ball.
Did you know that the NFL the coaches start looking at your child when they're in middle school?
I believe it.
They would strip them down into nothing but their shorts, and they look at their body. It's sort of like what they did at a slave market. Think about it.
Oh, really? I didn't know that was going on. I want to hold this up just for a bit because I got a lot of things I want to talk about today. This is an important topic. Pianki, we need to explore this more. I don't want to take Shannon's time right now with this particularly unless Shannon wants to. But this whole NFL thing, I'm not as familiar with it. And if they're exploiting kids like a slave market, then we need to know that. That's something we should definitely talk about. But I want to give
Shannon sits on the board, she's going back and forth with other members. Well, you got to have a card you got to throw on the table, too. They throw a card on the table against your suggestions and what you would like to see. Well, hell, if we can't have this, you can't have that. I mean, we got to get tough with these people.
Yeah.
I try to get tough by calling the council members out on representing their constituents. And I make it very public at the meeting. I make it very public on social media to try to draw the constituents' attention to what's going on at a meeting, because unfortunately we don't get a lot of participation at our meetings. So things can happen that the public doesn't know about.
Well, meetings are usually held at a time that people are still working and they're boring. City council meetings, unless you're there, you know, it's a participation sport. It's fun for you because you're actually at the meeting. You get to vote and you get to talk and all kinds of stuff. But for most people watching, unless it's a vital interest for them, you know, that's a problem. Hopefully, you know, we get more folks. I'm not a big fan of meetings. You know, I like to do my work, you know, here and with legislation. I just want to touch on the medical freedom thing again, just for a quick minute, because that is so important. I'm really glad you guys did that, because the biggest suppression of information, you know, was on COVID early treatments, ivermectin, hydroxychloroquine, things like that. Doctors they had gag orders from their hospitals. They had gag orders from the CDC, even though they weren't mandated. They weren't, you know, official. They were official enough. And people were treating them as if they were mandates. And people and doctors, you know, could lose their license over talking about things that they knew worked, like, you know, hydroxychloroquine, ivermectin, vitamin D3, things like that. And so it is so critical to have medical freedom, you know, for our doctors. Now, I think the state passed that law. Do you know what's going on with that one, Shannon, or no?
I don't know all the details of it. I know it's been talked about. I don't know where it is at this point. I personally went and met with the CEO of Santa Rosa Medical Center here in our city. And I thought I was just going to meet with him, but it turned out to be like a round table type discussion. So there was probably six other people.
Surprise. Yeah.
But that was interesting.
Ambush.
It's fine. I can handle it. But, you know, we didn't agree because the thought was that vaccines were a good thing. And I was arguing that it doesn't really matter to me if they're a good or a bad thing. I just don't want you to – I don't think we should force that on people.
So, and this was the Santa Rosa Hospital was saying this, or who are you meeting with?
Well, that what was happening was is they had a requirement for the nurses to be vaccinated or
right.
to
I remember that.
Be tested periodically whenever that was. So I went in. He invited me. You know, I don't get involved with the businesses, just like I. I wouldn't go and tell a business how to operate. So I'm not getting into that, but, I didn't call him that I wouldn't be so bold as to say, I'm going to come and meet with you business and tell you how to operate. I don't think that's right. But I expressed that I didn't like it, up on the dais. So, and they had heard about it and I had made a couple posts on social media and, so he invited me in for a talk and, you know, we just left knowing that we're not going to agree with each other.
No, there was David Jones when he was calling into the show. He's with Santa Rosa Volunteers. They were doing a lot of work with Santa Rosa Hospital, and I remember there was some at the county level. They were thinking of either revoking something of their leases, you know, over these mandates, which were just horrendous. You know, they were firing people for not, you know, taking a jab that they have no right to force people to take. You know, I call it snake oil for a reason. You know, I got reports from Australia of athletes just dropping dead. You know, that's the most recent stuff. UK, England, you know, soccer players are dropping dead. I still think Brian Sicknick, the officer, Capitol Hill police officer that died shortly after January 6th, you know, it's every reason to believe that those two strokes for, you know, a young 40-ish guy were caused by the COVID shot. You know, so there's all these things going on. And so the idea of forcing people to take something that we know is killing people is irrational. It's insane. And so there's no reason for them to do that. So any kind of mandate, you know, those are the things that have to be gotten rid of. And I think those are gone now. As far as I know, you got Dr. Lapido, Surgeon General of Florida, and you got Governor DeSantis. So as far as I know, they've gotten rid of those mandates, or are they still trying to push them, you know, at the hospital level?
I don't know. So many other things come up, and I hadn't been on your show in a while, so I was just trying to catch up on things done.
Okay. We got new businesses. We got anybody new in town? Any exciting new things coming in to our little place here?
Most recent, I stopped by a business opening in the old Napa building, which isn't going to mean anything to the constituents other than that it's a very large building and it's going to be an indoor shooting range. It's going to have Yeah, they're going to have, which I find very interesting, it's called a rage room. Not my cup of tea. I don't
a
like
rage
to break
room?
Things.
Wait, you got a rage room? We get to go rage? What, is this like a mosh pit or something? Or do we get to slam dance too? This is like the easier back.
They're going to design it as a room you go into and turn the music up very loud and break things, which I just find
that sounds
so,
like half the clubs I went to in the 80s. What are you talking about?
It makes me laugh.
Nothing new.
But I think that it would be a really funny gift certificate to give to somebody. Like, if you know somebody that gets very angry, you give them a
birthday card. This is the age to rage.
Yeah, good one. So that'll be fun. They're going to have, I think, paintball and archery and a lot of things going on in this building and in the area around the building. So
that'll be fun. I love archery.
I
miss archery. I used to take my daughter. We had this wonderful place in the East Bay of San Francisco called the Chabot Observatory. And we go watch, stars at night, and everybody bring their telescopes and beautiful reflecting, 6-inch mirror telescopes. And they're actually better in many ways than the old style refracting, huge early, 1900s, scopes they were using at the observatory. But they had this huge hill behind the observatory, and they had these winding trails. It was like Robin Hood. And you'd have targets along the way, so you felt like you were hunting. And you could shoot across these little valleys and gullies and things, and you'd shoot up and shoot down. And it was great. It was really fun. We were always conscious of other people, around, and there weren't that many. So it was, especially like on a Friday afternoon. So we go after school, and I picked her up. And sometimes they have space alien targets, and sometimes they have critters. But, yeah, it was really fun. I loved archery. We had a blast. And so we get an archery range back here. I still got my bow and arrow sitting on top of the cabinets here. So it's just a question of getting it strung, getting back out there, and getting my archery back. That and paintball. Paintball's fun, too.
Small town, and in small towns, people, are often looking for more things to do. I hear that a lot, more things to do. So that's pretty exciting. They're coming. Still growing. Businesses coming in. Some businesses have moved out, but it's just all shifting around. It'll be interesting to see what happens over this next year with all the growth that we've experienced.
How about the waterfront? Anything going to go right on the water? We've got this beautiful dock. It'd be a great place for, a wine bar, outdoor cafe kind of place or something. With tables right on the waterfront.
Yes, we had talked about some development coming down that way, a large riverfront development that hasn't moved forward yet. And then recently a parcel did sell down by the river, so hopefully that'll turn into something. It's over near where Bands on the Blackwater is, so good location. Okay. But I don't have any insider info on what they're doing or anything with it. But I imagine water-related, you wouldn't buy on the water if it's not something.
Well, yeah, and occasionally we get hurricanes and the water does rise, so there are occupational hazards. She was like 14 feet or something. I remember watching the water come up Willing Street's our main street in town. And I've still got pictures. I put them on Facebook. It's pretty interesting. But this is the perfect town to develop some really incredible stuff. And we've talked about this before. And there's still the idiots that want to put a freeway right through the middle of our town and destroy it. And we can have that argument sometime again too. But it'd be nice to have like an Italian restaurant. A crazy hat shop. Some fun stuff. Riverboat tours. We have a big riverboat should park itself here. Maybe Friday through Sunday or something like that. There's just so many things that we could do here. We got free concerts. We got these, great restaurant opportunities. And again, we got this courthouse we could turn into this funky marketplace, sort of like what happens over in Pensacola and Palafox Street. But we could do a similar thing here with some really nice markets, some farmers markets downtown. We have restaurants scattered around the town, but if they had like little satellite operations downtown, that would help out too. Yeah, go ahead. What were you going to say? Because I have another idea.
Yes, we just need people to come in and want to invest in our community. And what I can do is, to help our city be business friendly. And I do have conversations with the city manager and get that passed along to economic development that, we need to look at people. If someone comes into City Hall or calls City Hall and says they want to do business here in the city, they need to grab a hold of that person and close that deal and help make that happen.
Yeah.
I'm not sure how much that happens, but I encourage it.
Yeah.
And
well, tell you what,
anyone to reach out to me too.
Well, yeah, I was just going to play my Milton promotion that I made for everybody here in town. And after that, you can give some contact information. And, of course, it'll be on the podcast so people can listen anytime. Let's take a quick break, and we'll be right back.
This is Greg Penglis, creator of Action Radio for my town, Milton, Florida. Milton, it's where I live. It's where you can live, too. It's where you can bring a new business, especially a business that helps our downtown historic district. We have everything in Milton. We have the Blackwater River. We have the Imogene Theater, built in 1912 and still booking national acts. We have Scoops Ice Cream. We have Boomerang's Restaurant, where I get my favorite Thai chicken pizza. We have an outdoor stage for music acts and free concerts by the river. The Blackwater Bistro will keep you in steak and seafood indefinitely. We have brew pubs creating great craft beers and giving us all a place to relax and talk. But it's more than just stuff and food and buildings. It's people. Remember the show Cheers, where everybody knows your name? It's that kind of place. So if you're tired of the cities, of the traffic, the frenetic pace of life that doesn't seem to get you anywhere, if you want a small city that has incredible potential, that combines the best of historic buildings and modern, fun, small retail shops and restaurants, and a great waterfront, plus who knows what for the future, take a look at historic Milton, Florida, in the Panhandle, near Pensacola, and the world's greatest beaches on the Emerald Coast of the Gulf of Mexico. Milton is going through a renaissance. Maybe you can be part of making it happen.
Damn, I want to go there. Hey, Shannon, let's get some contact info.
If someone wants to contact me, it's F. Rice, F as in Shannon, R-I-C-E, at MiltonFL.org.
Use a little tag music in the end, too. Yeah. Okay, sounds good. Hey, Bianchi, what do you think? You want to come check out our town?
Sounds like it's a lot of fun.
Well, especially coming from the Bay Area, you know, in that bastion of Marxism, to be able to come here back to America, it's really great. You know, so it's a small town. Everybody knows everybody here. You know, it's pretty crazy. So I kind of like that. You know, Mellencamp was right. You know, I grew up in a small town. I want to live in a small town. And, you know, it's kind of fun here. All right. Anything else you think we should be covering, Shannon? And we've covered a good amount of stuff this morning.
I think we've got what's going on, the big items, you know. I'm not seeking re-election. I think I've you may have heard that. I'm going to
okay.
It's been a very busy. Will have been a very busy 4 years, and I'm going to take a little bit of time off, focus on my health, and I may come back and get involved again in a couple of years. So may continue to do some of my small business highlights. I've grown to really like that and like helping the small businesses around, but I'm going to finish up my term, do what I said I would do when I ran, and this was never anything that I wanted to make a career out of. I just ran to help my city, and at the end I will hopefully have done that. So.
Well, there's a ton of things you can do. I mean, especially now that you're known, you know, for the city council. But promoting businesses, I mean, you're always welcome to come on the show here, Monday mornings especially. You know, if there's new business coming to town, anything, and bring them on. Just bring them right on the show. I mean, you know, I want to be that's part of my deal being a service to this area is to help these newer businesses. So the shooting folks, indoor shooting range, are you kidding? In Milton, this is going to be great. I'll be there. Look out for the show, you know, fire off a couple hundred rounds, you know, and just practice my art of shooting. And because, you know, we have Chappie Tactical and Firearms. Donnie Chapman's on Fridays, and he runs the competitions around here. He's got his own competition league, and they shoot up a cantonment at the Escambia River Gun Club. But, yeah, maybe I can drag him down here, and he's, you know, promised to teach me a lesson because I haven't shot for a while, so I need to get back and practice. And so this might be kind of fun. Maybe we'll start a shooting league, Sharon. Shannon, excuse me. Michael, Shannon.
Yeah, and I'm not sure who all's involved with this. It's a pretty big venture. It's a big building and so many different things going on in there. So the person you mentioned may be
Radio
involved,
Shooting Club. Yeah, let's the Action Radio team. Yes, from microphones to guns. This is going to be fun. Be like a bowling league, only we'll do it with guns. We'll see who's got.
I mean,
who's got the eye. Let's see who's got the hand-eye coordination. Are they going to do competition stuff at all, or is it more just the practice range and lessons and things like that?
You know, I didn't ask him about that. It was a impromptu walkthrough of his business. I just actually was at a little thrift store that's kind of next to it. And heard about it, and he was in the area, so I introduced myself, and he asked me if I wanted to walk through, and he would show it to me, and I did, and I was like, wow, I didn't know this was happening. That's so exciting. People are
so I look at myself, too, and I want to go walk through as well. So where's it located, or can we tell it right now or not yet?
It's on Elva Street. It's the old Napa building. It's behind Burger King.
Okay, I'll have to look it up. Oh, okay. Oh, yeah. Okay. That's not that far away. This is great. Oh, I love it. Okay, cool. All right. I tell you what.
No,
let's,
small city.
Yeah.
You know.
Okay. Yeah. No kidding. Yeah. But just have a shooting range in town that I don't have to drive, miles and miles to. This is great. This is gonna be so much fun. Yeah. I got some ammo. I've been sort of getting ready to do. And the guns are ready. I got to practice. I mean,
it's a small city when you can describe things as behind the Burger King and it's the big building.
Yeah, find Fred's old oak tree. Okay, there it is. Yeah, so turn left at the blue fence and right at remember that tree that branch that got knocked down in the storm? Yeah, there. Okay, that's the tree. Here, right, fine.
Fred's
on the porch, so wave at Fred as you go, and then and he'll wish you a good day, and then hey, you go, you have a great time. Okay, wonderful place here, Melbourne. Yeah, we all sit down, we're talking, we're having too much fun. I sound like Jed and the Beverly Hillbillies. This is terrible. All right, let me play a Santa Rosa Volunteers piece. Shannon, if you want to stick around, you're welcome to. If not, if you have to go, that's okay too. But I want to get into my. Okay, I want to talk about oil. Oil is not a fossil fuel. Oil is renewable. It's the three big myths of this last week are one that state land is federal land. It isn't. It's actually state land out west. The second is that carbon dioxide is really good for the environment. We need more of it. And the third one is that oil is not a fossil fuel. So these are the three big lies. I'll probably put them all in a press release pretty soon. Thanks, Shannon. Let's do it again soon.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on. Have a good day.
All right. You have a good day, too. All right. Back in a little bit. This is Greg Penglis for Action Radio with Founding Moments, insights into our founding documents, sponsored by Santa Rosa Volunteers here in Santa Rosa County, Florida. Santa Rosa Volunteers is available at their website, srv1776.com. That's srv1776.com. Federalist Papers No. 9 was written by our now familiar friend, Alexander Hamilton, November 21st, 1787. And again, he starts in on how the Constitution is required to keep a firm union, which he defines right in the beginning. A firm union will be of the utmost moment to the peace and liberty of the states, as a barrier against domestic faction and insurrection. It is impossible to read the history of the petty republics of Greece and Italy without feeling sensations of horror and disgust at the distractions with which they were continually agitated and at the rapid succession of revolutions by which they were kept in a state of perpetual vibration between the extremes of tyranny and anarchy. Why he compares us to ancient Greece and Italy, which had completely separate city-states like Sparta and Athens, who went to war with each other, as a justification for a strong central government under the new constitution as a barrier against domestic faction and insurrection, where some 73 years later the U.S. had become completely factioned and was in fact in a civil war, is a complete mystery. But he does love that recurring theme.
leaving behind the ancients who screwed up their republics with despots who created tyrannies over the people, Hamilton makes a huge leap to our modern republic, and after saying the science of politics has received great improvement, then perfectly describes the way a republic is supposed to be characterized, saying this: the regular distribution of power into distinct departments, the introduction of legislative balances and checks, the institution of courts composed of judges holding their offices during good behavior, the representation of the people in the legislature by deputies of their own election. These are wholly new discoveries, or have made their principal progress towards perfection in modern times. They are means, and powerful means, by which the excellences of a republican government may be retained and its imperfections lessened or avoided. One imperfection that needs immediate addressing is that judges need to be held to good behavior and not the mythical lifetime appointment. The biggest problem with Hamilton is that he likes the adulation he obviously received for bringing into his Federalist Papers so many irrelevant examples of failed governments, and from those false comparisons projected what would happen should the new Constitution not be ratified. This is disingenuous. However, if you look carefully through the long paragraphs of fluff, he has his moments of brilliance. So let me set aside all the philosophers he quotes and the foreign failures that don't apply, and end with a moment of clarity for Hamilton. He says, "The proposed Constitution, so far from implying an abolition of the state governments, makes them constituent parts of the national sovereignty by allowing them a direct representation in the Senate, and leaves in their possession certain exclusive and very important portions of sovereign power. This fully corresponds in every rational import of the terms with the idea of a federal government." Oh, if only the states had retained their direct representation in the Senate, that the income tax were still apportioned by population and paid by the states and not by individuals, and if only our money came from the U.S. Treasury and not the Federal Reserve, maybe we wouldn't be where we are. So maybe the problems with the Constitution are not so much as it was ratified, but much more how it was amended. I'll be considering that prospect a lot more in future Founding Moments. The source for the Federalist Papers is federalistpapers.org. The Anti-Federalist Papers are from selfeducatedamerican.com. The Articles of Confederation are from usconstitution.net. This is Greg Penglis for Action Radio with Founding Moments, sponsored by Santa Rosa Volunteers. Their website is srv1776.com. That's srv1776.com. Please share this report to anyone who needs it.
Okay, we're back here. We've got Pianchi live. His line's actually still in live. Pianchi, welcome to join me in this discussion. We've got an hour before Dr. Pry gets here. And I've just been going crazy. Like I say, I wanted to do some things for the truckers. And that was for that big show last Monday with Dr. Roger Roots. It was actually on for 2 hours. It was incredible. Talking about the history of land out west, how the federal government took over the territories. And then they, as they converted them to states, you know, they treated the states like they were still territories, and they kept their land. Nevada is 85% stolen federal land. You know, I think Montana is about 60% stolen federal land. California is probably about 50% stolen federal land. And all these states out west, from, if you draw a line from Montana down to New Mexico, you know, right there at the Continental Divide, all those states that were formed after a certain period in the 1800s, they all have stolen federal land. You know, it's state land. And it was, you know, and they need that land back. And the reason they need that land back is to start exploring for oil and natural gas and uranium and anything else they want to explore for. And the federal government is locking up land that they're not entitled to have anything to do with, you know, through the BLM, the Bureau of Land Management. It's not Black Lives Matter. The Bureau of Land Management, the Forest Service, and various other, you know, illegal federal institutions that are continuing to steal the land. And the states are continuing to let them. Well, that's the first problem. The second problem, of course, is carbon dioxide. There's this big myth that, oh, the world's warming up and carbon dioxide is causing global climate change and the seas are rising. We're all going to drop dead in 5 years. That's a bunch of nonsense, too. CO2 has been proven over and over again. I read you a whole bunch of studies last week, you know, on how we could do more of it, how the Sahara is greening, how the Australian desert is greening, the Gobi is greening. You know, these areas that the rainforests are getting more rain. They're getting more forest. You know, things that the carbon dioxide is a good thing. And so this myth that we need to eliminate our carbon dioxide, you know, and we need to get rid of vehicles, you know, unless they're electric. And, of course, how do you think electricity is made? You know, coal, oil, natural gas, and uranium. Okay, nuclear power. It's just crazy. And so these idiots that are talking about, well, it's a zero-emission vehicle. Really? Have you seen the lithium mines that go to make the batteries for electric cars? You want to talk about emissions? You want to talk about environmental destruction? You want to talk about exploitation of poor folks in you know, I think it's African countries mostly? Yeah. Well, then tell me about your electric car and how politically correct you think it really is. But the third thing of our series is the fact that oil is a renewable resource. I've talked about it a little bit. I've investigated a little bit. But this weekend, I really got into it. So I started perusing all the articles I could. I have a bunch of them here, a bunch of them for you. And so I'll just kind of go through until I get bored. But let's talk about this. And Pianki, well, you want to join me anytime, feel free. Yeah, go ahead, Pianki.
Yeah, I'm here now. You know, you're absolutely right. I want my land back, Greg. I want my land back.
We should have. Well, yeah, how much of Missouri is illegally federally controlled?
I couldn't tell you at the time being. But even if it's a block, we want our land back. Mm-hmm. And see, here's the thing. Just like you made mention, I talked to this, a matter of fact, of the Black program yesterday, and I told them, I said, states need to reclaim their land.
Yeah,
man,
you call my show?
Bunkers over that. They couldn't imagine. No
really?
Kidding, honest. But, see, you got people who are conditioned to think that the federal government is the God Almighty. And this is what states should do, is say, well, if you don't give us the land back, we're going to cut your water and electric off.
No, you don't have to do anything. You just kick them off. See, the thing is, it's not federal land. They have no claim to it. So
let me tell you that.
Okay. Yeah, okay.
Because if they're there illegally, then utilities and other concerns should not be providing them with services. Now, you ever heard of Philadelphia and the organization called MOOG?
I remember MOOG. They had a bomb dropped on them by the mayor. Yeah, I remember MOOG.
Absolutely. You know what they done first, though? They cut off the services.
Yeah.
They cut the services off, the electric and the water. They said, you're illegal. Get out.
Yeah.
And then, you know, one thing led to another. But no, same thing with a drug house. You have, when it becomes a nuisance, then you declare it a nuisance, then you have the utility to cut off the utilities to it, electric and water. You know, there's many ways to solve these problems. Conservatives got to be more, have more footballs that they seemingly don't have.
The geldings, you know, we need stallions, and we've got geldings. You know, it ain't going to happen. In fact, the biggest stallions are usually women. Marjorie Taylor Greene, Lauren Boebert, some of the strongest people in the Republican Party. Kristi Noem, governor of South Dakota. You know, so I got more faith than some of the younger folks like Madison Cawthorn and some of the real firebrands out there, you know. But I don't have, you know, for the most part, you know, any Republican over 40 is probably a gelding. You know, they're useless. They're dead weight. They're sitting around just getting fat, and they want their government privilege. You know, it's not white privilege or black privilege so much as it's government privilege. That's the real privilege that is the problem. You know, it's the government supremacy.
Well, but they use the words white privilege and white supremacy to paralyze people while they go in and rob them and come out undeterred.
Yeah.
That's,
no,
so
I
you
use
don't
it,
fight them.
Yeah, you know me. I use those terms out of convenience.
If you fight them the same way, they're going to get you all the time.
Yeah. If someone actually called me a white supremacist, I'd call them a racist, and we'd have a really interesting discussion. You know, it's like you can't use a racist epithet like that on my show. You know, and so that's where we're getting
there
really
you go, Greg.
That's where we get very interesting.
Right.
So, well, tell me about the show you're on. You call it the Black Show, which I think is kind of interesting. I'd love to go on just because I'd love to be on Black Show. I mean, that'd just be, you know, I'm just that kind of spunky guy. I would do that kind of stuff. But what were they talking about in terms of land use? Did they have no clue? Because most people don't. They live by assumptions. You know, I've said for years, assumptions are stronger than truth. So they were assuming that the federal government has the right to the land that all this land in these states. I mean, just on its face, that doesn't make any sense. Why would the federal government have claim to land in a state, especially when the states are independent? That makes no sense.
That's a lot of assumptions that out of black society, they've been conditioned. Right. They have turned to the federal government for everything. You know, just like some of these John Lewis bills, Voting Act bills, and Sheila Jackson Lee controlling guns violence in her district, which used to be that of Barbara Jordan and Mickey Leavish, I think his name was.
No, like
they want to go to federal government, then handling those problems themselves locally.
Well, that's interesting.
And they just leave.
But I think a lot of people are conditioned too, because you got the states that, you know, and this is the thing we talked about with Dr. Roots is that the states don't need the federal government's permission. You don't ask the feds to leave. You cut off their services and you say, look, you know, leave your guns. We're going to donate them to, you know, poor folks so they can have equal access to quality firearms and ammunition and get the hell out of here, you know, and just go. You know, you change the signs, you know, you cut down the fences, you know, and it's like, you guys are out of here. Just move them out, you know, and if they won't go quietly, then you escort them out with the state National Guard and say, look, we're going to take you to the state border, but you're not going to be here anymore. You know, the states don't need permission. They don't need a Supreme Court case. They don't need a law in Congress. The Constitution already states very clearly that this is state land. The minute a state becomes a state, all federal territory reverts to the state. They're just not claiming it, but they should. Let me get into oil because I want to make sure I get – I got like 3 hours of stuff and I got like less than an hour to cover it. I'll probably pick it up tomorrow. Listen, this is Forbes. Now, this is – I got a bunch of different articles here. Robert Langreth, and this is Forbes. This article – it says this article is more than 10 years old. So this is not new information, folks. This is – you just haven't heard it for a while. He said – I've forgotten to – I can't find a date on it. Let's just say it. We'll call it over 10 years old. He says, everybody knows oil and gas drilled out of the earth comes from the remains of plants and animals trapped underground millions of years ago. This received wisdom so dominates our thinking that is enshrined in the very language we use, fossil fuels. They took eons to form, and we are using them up far faster than they can be replenished. And then he says, what if the whole theory is wrong? Which is what I believe, right? That's the premise of a small but passionate band of Russian and Ukrainian contrarians. Now, notice it's Russian and Ukrainian. I'll get more of that later. But you'll see that Russia and Ukraine figure prominently in this abiotic theory. Burisma, Biden family. We'll develop that as we go. Anyway, it says that's the premise of a small but passionate band of Russian and Ukrainian contrarians. They argue that oil and gas don't come from fossils. They're synthesized deep within the Earth's mantle by heat, pressure, and other purely chemical means before gradually rising to the surface. Under the so-called abiotic theory of oil, finding all the energy we need, it's just a matter of looking beyond the traditional basins where fossils might have accumulated. The idea that oil comes from fossils is a myth. We need to change this myth. And that comes from petroleum engineer Vladimir Kucherov at the Royal Institute of Technology in Sweden.
You know what?
Yeah, Sweden, yeah. All kinds of rocks could have oil and gas deposits. Yeah, go ahead. Yes, sir.
He's absolutely right.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I love when you say that.
I can't pronounce the word abiotic. I use it to say aerobotic, but it's produced
there's
the middle of the earth. What the heck would dinosaurs be doing down there anyway, partying?
Well, apparently there's you know, billions and billions and billions of microbes, you know, that live off this stuff. So oil actually, the things we don't know about the earth so far exceed what we do know. But abiotic, there's biotic, B-I-O-T-I-C, biotic. In other words, bio comes from life. Abiotic means it doesn't come from life. It's chemical. So oil being a chemical, I mean, they're hydrocarbons. There's nothing particularly, living about hydrocarbons. Hydrocarbons are hydrogen and carbon. That's what hydrocarbons are. You know, same thing like carbohydrates that make up your food. You know, plants make it through photosynthesis and we eat it. that's how the world works, folks. Okay, so abiotic means non-biotic. That's what it is. Let me continue on. This is kind of funny. Anyway, so he says the Royal Institute of Energy, you know, all kinds of rocks could have oil and gas deposits. Alexander Kichka of the Ukrainian National Academy of Sciences. I think it's fascinating. This is Ukrainian with Burisma and Hunter Biden and everything else. I like I say, I haven't found the connection yet, but that's where my mind is going. The Ukrainian National Academy of Sciences brashly estimates that 60% of the content of all oil is abiotic in origin and not from fossil fuels. He says companies should drill deeper to find it. Kichka says oil may be found in all sorts of geological structures, such as volcanic rock or deep sea thermal vents, where companies aren't looking today. Yeah, you can't find it if you're not looking, right? Kucherov points to a handful of productive oil fields in Vietnam and elsewhere that lay in hard rock such as granite. Traditional theory says oil shouldn't be present there. Well, guess what? It is, all right? Certain wells in the Gulf of Mexico, this is where I am, down here at the Gulf, certain wells in the Gulf of Mexico have produced more oil than expected. The abiotic crowd says they are slowly being refilled from a deeper source. And we talked about, remember, Bianca, I've talked about this before, oil wells, they drill it, and then 5 years later, it's full. So wait a minute, how'd that happen? Well, oil, the earth makes oil. So it replenishes it. You put a big hole in the ground because you take out the oil and the natural gas. The oil fills, the world fills it up again. That's what happens. You know, so oil is a renewable resource. So all this doom and gloom and all this, we have to go to wind and solar and all this other nonsense that's costing you $5 a gallon. The only reason you're paying $5 a gallon is because of a political ideology, not a physical reality. It's a political ideology that says that carbon dioxide is bad, that oil's about to run out, that if we can just transfer our entire economy to electricity, you know, generated by wind and solar, the world will be a wonderful place. Well, the world's a wonderful place right now if you just leave us alone. You know, let's all drive 61 Corvettes, you know, with 402, you know, 450 Cleveland engines or whatever they put in those things, all right? There's no reason not to do that. Carbon dioxide is a good thing. You know, the stuff that comes out your tailpipe, sulfur dioxide, nitrogen dioxide, okay, fine. You know, so make the engines as clean as possible. But don't take away all our fun. This is really about so the problem with socialism is it takes away all your fun. You know, we were talking about Shannon with this earlier. You know, kids climbing trees and doing rough sports. In fact, I had to wrestle everybody in Australia. I really did. It was kind of funny, actually. Mm-hmm. It did pretty well, too. But, you know, it was a little weird.
You know.
Yeah. But anyway, yeah, I was a big kid. But, yeah, go ahead. But, yeah, oil. It's made naturally. The earth just makes
it. That may be the reason why come the West want to control Ukraine. So they don't be teaching that fact.
Yeah. I think yeah, you're absolutely right. And this is why I find the fact that the Russian Ukrainians are working on the abiotic theory so much. See, Russia never has run out of oil. Have you noticed that? There's never been an oil shortage in Russia. Well, why is that? They don't have a fortune to drill. They don't have the best scientists. They don't have the chemical engineers. Well, they do, but they don't have as many as we have. They don't have the resources. They don't have the money to set up wells everywhere to drill. So how is it they've never run out of oil? Well, because they keep drilling the same oil fields. They wait for them to fill, and then they take the oil out again. But nobody's talking about that because Russia that destroys the theory. Yeah.
Russia has some of the best learned institutions for that type of study, geology, and things along that line in the world, really.
Yeah, I got an article. Yeah. We got some great stuff about John D. Rockefeller and Stalin. I need to get to, you know, as we go through some of these articles. I want to go through them because they're all quite fascinating in their own way. And when it gets repetitive, I'll just kind of skip over it. But listen to this: the abiotic oil theory goes back centuries and includes as its prominent champions Dmitry Mendeleev. Now, I didn't know who he was. I'd forgotten. But he's best known for inventing the periodic table, okay? So if you don't know what the periodic table is, I want you to go to Tom Lehrer and listen to his song, The Periodic Table. He actually sings it, all right? But from hydrogen to uranium, from atomic matter, it was atomic weight and atomic number. Okay, atomic weight, the number of neutrons and electrons. Atomic number, the number of protons and neutrons, if I remember my high school chemistry. Anyway, hydrogen has an atomic number of 2, okay? One electron and one proton. That's it. Hydrogen. Okay, it's the building block of the universe. You know, in fact, splitting those up is what makes hydrogen bombs. And that's kind of interesting too. But the point is that the periodic table, the categorizing of the elements of the earth by atomic number and atomic weight, is what this guy did. He's a genius. All right, and he says he's best known for inventing the periodic table. It didn't gain much visibility in America until the late Cornell University astronomer Thomas Gold another one we heard about here, championed in the 1980s. He said that oil contains organic compounds not because it's derived from fossils, but because giant colonies of deep earth bacteria feed on deep hydrocarbon pools way down in the mantle. Think about that. Oil contains organic compounds.
Yeah, they feed on it.
Yeah. Yeah. Not, but it contains organic compounds. Not because,
and their waste is the oil. Their waste is the oil. Just like, that's why some things, when they rot, it stinks because the bacteria is pooping.
Well, I don't think that's, no, I don't think the waste product is the oil. That'd be like saying, you know, that's like wine is a product of fermentation when all the sugar is used up. I don't think it works that way. I think they just feed on it because it's hydrocarbon. Or maybe to them it's a carbohydrate. I mean, it's the same stuff. Hydrocarbons and carbohydrates. Hydrogen and carbon. You know, plus oxygen. This is hydrocarbons without oxygen because it's down below the earth. All right. So there's no oxygenating process. There's no oxygen involved with this. All right. See, that's the difference. This is non-oxygen oil. You know, and the fact that these deep earth bacteria are feeding on this stuff, feeding on the hydrocarbons, I'm not sure. They may be just the dead ones that are there mixing in. So the organic compounds might be the dead bacteria, not the fact that the oil is a result of them, you know, munching on oil and creating, you know, bacteria poop, and then we're burning that. I don't know. I mean, honestly, it's a great question, but it just says oil contains organic compounds, not because it's derived from fossils, but because giant colonies of deep earth bacteria, and these things must be massive, deep earth bacteria. We're talking thousands of cubic miles of bacteria. You know, it's an interesting thought, right?
Yeah, natural gas smell like rotten eggs, right?
No, they add that smell. That smell's artificially added. That's done so people don't die. Yeah, they put that in there to make sure, because natural gas has no smell. But they put that horrible aroma in. I forgot what the chemical's called. But they put it in so you know when there's a gas leak. Anyway, so bacteria feed deep hydrocarbon way down the mantle. Well, that might be their version of carbohydrates. I mean, hydrocarbon, same thing. You just a little bit. Anyway, let me continue. It says in the 1980s, he convinced the Swedish government and investors to drill 4 miles through solid granite in central Sweden. They eventually recovered 84 barrels of oil. Gold considered it a scientific success, even though the project was a commercial failure. Yeah, I mean, just because they didn't have enough oil, they didn't drill far enough or whatever. But anyway, in the 1980s, these guys are drilling in granite. Well, oil's not supposed to be in granite, and yet they found oil in granite. I mean, that's huge. Anyway. Back to the article. To prove that abiotic oil is possible, in 2002, Kucherov spearheaded calcium carbonate, no, superheated calcium carbonate, water, and iron in a pressure chamber, and then cranked it up to produce 30,000 times atmospheric pressure, simulating the conditions present in the Earth's mantle. Okay, so folks, the mantle's below the core. Okay, so, I mean, the mantle's below the crust. So you got the crust, you got the mantle, and you got the core. That's, if I remember my basic Earth geology. All right, simulating the conditions present in the Earth's mantle. Sure enough, about 1.5% of the material converted into hydrocarbons, according to the results in the proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. This isn't junk stuff. This is real science, folks, all right? And it says most of it was methane and other gases, but about 10% was heavier oil components. Well, what do you know? Fracking, you know, or this is basically oil refining under the earth into components of gas and heavier oil components. Okay, so the earth not only is making oil, it's refining it for us. This is fascinating. Anyway, so since then, in work slated for publication, Kucherov has shown that methane will convert into more complicated hydrocarbons under certain extreme conditions. Small amounts of natural gas that could be abiotic in origin have also been found in deep sea vents. Kucherov says methane is probably generated in the mantle, and depending on the conditions, it turns into heavier hydrocarbons as it bubbles up towards the surface. What do you think?
Yes, you have those bubbling up at the ocean floor bed all the time.
Oh, hey, listen, the whole Gulf of Mexico, oil's bubbling up. Off the coast of Santa Barbara, it's bubbling up. I mean, it just bubbles. I mean, the tar's in the beach, and as I explained before, people think, oh, it's from the oil rigs. No, it's not. It just bubbles up right from the ground. So much oil affects the sand. They can't grab it all. Anyway, it says since then, in work slated for publication, Kucherov has shown that methane will convert. I think I already said that. All right. Skeptics say that while traces of abiotic hydrocarbons may exist, little data to support the idea of economically meaningful. Little data to support the idea of economically meaningful deposits. Companies have been looking for oil for 100 years. If all this abiotic stuff is there, why haven't they found it? And that's the geochemist Jeffrey Glasby who spent 9 months investigating the matter for a 2006 review paper in Resource Geology. He concluded the totality of the evidence did not support the concept. Well, yeah, he's probably a government-paid or oil-paid executive that doesn't want to find that there's more than you know, than people could possibly imagine. He says there. This is a different one. This is Chevron geologist Barry Katz. Barry J. Katz said there's a difference between a few parts per million and tens of millions of barrels. He notes that the theory fails to explain the wide variety of biological compounds found in oil from different parts of the world. Well, he just explained that you've got all these bacterial there. Oil from younger rocks contains compounds linked to flowering plants, but oil from older rocks formed before flowering plants existed contains only more primitive organic compounds. Anyway, so it looks like they're discounting the theory here. It says American geologists might be convinced if the abiotic theorists can find big new oil fields using the methods. All right, yeah, let's, yeah, they were doing really well until they got to the end, and then they started saying, oh, no, this isn't working. Now, let me get you another article here. Pianki, you got a comment?
Well, you know, have you ever heard of pitch is nothing more, huh? Yeah, well, you heard about it. They used that pitch in ancient times to cover the hull of your boats and ships with. And also in
like
the erection of the pyramids, they used to use that pitch as a thin mortar, because there's no mortar joints on the stone that's in certain areas in the pyramids. So they spread it, the pitch, as a mortar joint. Then when it hard, I mean, there it is. They didn't have no cement mortar. They used that.
Yeah, no concrete in the pyramids. Yeah, it's kind of interesting. In fact, the really good stonemasons wouldn't use any mortar at all. They just you know, fit the stones together. Those are the real stonemasons. Anyway, got another one for you here. Midnight Rider News. This is from 10th of August, 2017. Alex Hiddell, oil as a fossil fuel, reality or received wisdom. Oh, there we go. The suggestion that petroleum might have arisen from some transformation of squashed fish or biological detritus is surely the silliest notion to have been entertained by substantial numbers of persons over an extended period of time. And that's Fred Hoyle, 1982, English astronomer, noted primarily for his contribution to the theory of stellar nucleosynthesis. I like that. You know, squash fish or biological detritus, the silliest notion to have been entertained. In other words, oil doesn't come from dead things, okay? It doesn't come from dinosaurs. He says the capital fact to note is that petroleum was born in the depths of the earth, and it is only there that we must seek its origin. And that's Mendeleev, the guy at the periodic table. And that was back in 1877. Petroleum was born in the depths of the earth, okay? Let me get another one here. Okay, there we go. Here's our author again. He says, sitting to write this piece, I was faced with a choice. Do I give a detailed yet concise explanation of what I have come to believe is the hoax that is fossil fuel, or do I keep it simple and give you abiogenic oil light? He says, the choice is easy. I'm not a physicist, geologist, or chemist, or for that matter, even a scientist of any discipline. Besides, in this instance, detailed yet concise is not an option, even for a physicist, geologist, or chemist, to prove what I am suggesting here would require hundreds of thousands of words and countless equations. Instead, I give you the short and snappy version from which to draw your own conclusions. For me, there is only one, and it's not this one. And the one he says it's not is the biogenic explanation. Under fossil fuel, Wikipedia, that bastion of knowledge, states, petroleum and natural gas are formed by the anaerobic decomposition of remains of organisms, including phytoplankton and zooplankton, that settle to the sea or lake bottom in large quantities under anoxic conditions, that's without oxygen, millions of years ago. Over geological time, this organic matter mixed with mud got buried under heavy layers of sediment. Well, I wonder how that happened. The resulting high levels of heat and pressure, how many layers would you get high heat and pressure, right? Resulting high levels of heat and pressure caused the organic matter to chemically alter, first into a waxy material known as kerogen, which is found in oil shales, and then with more heat into liquid and gaseous hydrocarbons in the process known as catagenesis. Despite these heat-driven transformations, which may increase the energy density compared to typical organic matter, the embedded energy is still photosynthetic in origin. All right, so it says oil comes from photosynthesis. And then the author says, note the absence of the word theory. The above description is presented as fact beyond question or discussion. It's kind of like the theory of evolution. There is no coincidence, but nor is it likely it is intentional on the part of the author. He says, oh, this is no coincidence. I'm sorry, I read too fast. This is no coincidence, but nor is it likely it is intentional on the part of the author. The sad fact is that human beings are incredibly gullible and easily manipulated. Very few people question anything, let alone anything as heady as the origin of oil. Unless, of course, you listen to my show, because we question stuff like this all the time. It has probably never occurred to the writer that what they are referring to is mere theory, just as it never occurs to most folk that reputable news agencies are only reputable because nobody questions them. 9/11 sorted that little anomaly out for me. He says, unless someone lived long enough to observe the process, it is, like most things we take for granted, yes, including the laws of physics, a supposition. So here for your consideration is another theory, the abiogenic explanation. This is the one I like. Russian geologist Nikolai Andreevich Kudyatsev, there we go. Nikolai Andreevich Kudyatsev was the first to propose the modern abiotic theory of petroleum in 1951. He analyzed the geology of the Athabasca tar sands in Alberta, Canada, and concluded that no source rocks could form the enormous volume of hydrocarbons estimated today, 1.7 trillion barrels. Let me say that again. Alberta, Canada, you know the place we're going to get the Keystone Pipeline? Okay. 1.7 trillion barrels. That's enough to last us several hundred years, right? And that, therefore, the most plausible explanation is abiotic deep petroleum. This petroleum is thought to be a product of the natural geological mechanisms at work deeper than the earth, much deeper than the more traditionally exploited wells common for the last 100 years. So point of all this is that there's so much oil down there, we've been looking in the wrong place. You know, they're trying to measure how much oil there is using only this biotic theory that oil comes from dinosaurs and should be close to the surface. And it might be completely false. I think it is completely false. There's probably so much oil down there they haven't even found yet, that there's no reason not to drive your truck, you know, your 1961 Corvette. Why not? Everybody should have a V8.
Well, you know,
we got the oil for it. You know, price of gas should probably be about 25 cents a gallon again, if these supplies can be released. Go ahead.
You know, being that oil that's coming from Alberta, Canada, we probably should boycott that the way the Canadian government was treating the truckers.
Well, I agree with you. I think that makes perfect sense. But the point is the oil's there. I'm not politics so much this time as science. That we've got, you know, they've been looking for oil in the wrong place the last 100 years. They have no idea how much oil is down there. They have no idea even where to look. We haven't really started. I mean, oil could, you know, what if 3,000 years from now they're still using oil because the earth keeps making it because it's the most efficient source of power, you know, for a bunch of different things. You don't know. Yeah, they might go to hydrogen fuel cells, but oil, hey, you know, maybe, I don't know, more plastic. Article says, although this theory is largely supported by geologists in Russia and Ukraine, the Ukraine keeps popping up again, this is what I find fascinating, it has recently begun to receive attention in the West, where the biogenic petroleum theory is accepted by the vast majority of petroleum geologists. Well, there you go. It says Kutria, yeah, in other words, yeah, they still do the biogenic one. So in other words, you know, plants, dinosaurs, that kind of crap. Kudryatsev's work was continued by many Russian researchers. Peter N. Kropotkin, Vladimir P. Borfinev. Anyway, got a bunch of people here. All right. Anyway, physicist Thomas Gold, remember him from the previous article, was one of the abiogenic theory's most prominent proponents in recent years in the West until his death in 2004. Dr. Jack Kenney of the Gas Resources Corporation is perhaps the foremost proponent in the West. The theory receives continued attention in the media as well as in scientific journals. Like I said, this is not new. This is not revolutionary. This is what's going on. But this is a theory that has been suppressed because the left particularly does not want you to know that there's an unlimited supply of oil because the earth makes it. They don't want you to know that. They don't want you to know that you don't need solar power. You don't need wind power. That the price of gasoline should probably be, like I say, with all the abiotic oil out there, it should probably be 25, 50 cents a gallon. There's no reason for oil to cost that much. There's so much of it out there. The supply is immense. We couldn't possibly use it up. But the oil companies want to keep the price high, so they limit the supply, and that's how they do it. And now the government, you know, under the Marxists, want to limit it even more, so much that you don't even have any. They don't think you should even drive a car. You know, they want you an electric little putt-putt, you know, or an electric vehicle. Of course, where do you think they get the electricity from? Yeah, usual sources, right? Anyway, here's Pianki, this is where it gets interesting, right? Enter John D. Rockefeller, In 1892, the Geneva Congress on Organic Nomenclature codified organic substances ostensibly for commercial purposes. John D. Rockefeller made sure oil was included as an organic substance. He did this by placing his own pet scientist, who successfully argued that oil was organic and thus finite. This is how he could make more money, right? Supply and demand. This is described by none other than Mr. X himself, Leroy Fletcher Prouty, in a widely available YouTube video where he discusses this and his own experiences while working with the railroad industry. So there you go. Rockefeller, who also, you know, is the one behind a lot of our medicine right now, a lot of our pharmaceuticals, oil-based pharmaceuticals, right? Rockefeller did some terrible things. But one of the ones was having oil listed as organic only. And it still is. You know, again, if they can convince you that there's a finite supply of oil, they can charge more for it and release only as much as they want. Or whatever they do release, they can charge a lot more than they would have gotten if everybody realized that the supply is probably limitless. I find that fascinating. Stalin, next category here. From this obscure meeting, the notion that oil is a finite, precious resource became an accepted fact. Flat earthers. We should start calling the flat earth fossil fuel theory. Right? Anyway, this is half a century later as the U.S. decided to isolate the USSR, the Soviet Union, the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, as a boogeyman. Stalin tasked his geologists to scour the USSR for oil resources and knowledge that he needed to be self-sufficient. The diligent Russians, this is what Pianki was talking about earlier, the diligent Russians decided to first establish what it was they were looking for before beginning their search. They concluded that oil is a product of continuing mechanisms within the Earth's mantle. The ramifications of this are enormous. Although strictly not limitless, the abiotic theory suggests that oil is immeasurably more abundant than the biogenic hypothesis dictates. And then it says, is there any proof of the abiotic theory? Short answer, yes. Now we get to my home. The Gulf of Mexico is where deep drilling is revealing enormous reserves, in fact highlighted by the recent BP oil spill. That spill was worsened by the enormous pressures the oil was under, pressures the biogenic theory says oil cannot exist without becoming a gas. So there you go. So, Pianki, you remember, I wasn't here. I was actually in California during the Gulf of Mexico oil spill. I got here a couple of years after it was capped. But you remember all the trouble they had capping it, and there was so much oil released, you know, and they couldn't stop it. You know, all this pressure just blew pressure out this stuff. Yeah. Well, that's
the thing. Those releases occur all the time at the ocean bed. Mm-hmm. You just don't see them.
Yeah.
And you know another thing, oil evaporates. Did you know that?
Mm-hmm. Yep, it also breaks down. Microbes break it down. So
it
the microbes in the ocean,
evaporate.
I think the microbes in the ocean use it as food. Yeah.
Matter of fact, one of the methods of cleaning up an oil spill is to release this biotic powder, which is nothing more than a bacteria. I guess a suspended bacteria, and it just eats it up.
Yep. Is it a bacteria or an algae? I'm just curious. I'm not sure the difference. I know what you're talking about, though. Yeah, it's a biological cure. It's a biological cure for oil spills. Yep. Here we go. Here's another quote for you. No one has been more astonished by the potential implications of our work than myself. And this is analytic chemist Gene Whalen at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution in Massachusetts. Very prestigious place. There already appears to be a large body of evidence consistent with oil and gas generation and migration on very short timescales in many areas globally. And she wrote this in the journal Sea Technology. Almost equally surprising, she added, is that there seem to be no compelling arguments refuting the existence of these rapid dynamic migration processes. Okay, the first sketchy evidence of this emerged in 1984 when Kennicott and colleagues from Texas A&M University were in the Gulf of Mexico trying to understand a phenomenon called SEEPs, S-E-E-P-S, areas on the seafloor where sometimes large amounts of oil and gas escape through natural fissures. This is what you were talking about, Pianki. Mm-hmm. Our first discovery was with trawls. We knew it was an area of massive seepage, and we expected that the oil seeps would poison everything around the site. But they found just the opposite. On the first trawl, we brought up 2 tons of stuff. We had a tough time getting the nets back on board because they were so full of very odd-looking seafloor creatures. I guess there's like all these critters live in this stuff, right? Kennicott said they were long straw-like things that turned out to be tube worms. The clams were the first thing I noticed, she added. They were pretty big, like the size of your hand, and it was obvious they had red blood inside, which is unusual, and these long tubes, three, 4 or 5 feet long. We didn't know what they were, but they started bleeding red fluid. We didn't know what to make of it. So the biologists they consulted did not know what to make of it either. The experts immediately recognized them as chemosynthetic communities, creatures that get their energy from hydrocarbons, oil and gas, rather than from ordinary food. So it's just what we're talking about, right? So the critters that eat the oil that comes out of the ocean. So these animals are very much like, but still different from, recently discovered creatures living near very hot seafloor vents in the Pacific, Atlantic, and other oceans. Think about that. Creatures that get their energy from hydrocarbons, oil, and gas, rather than from ordinary foods. Interesting, huh?
That tells it all. And I still say one of the reasons West, the deep state, want to get a hold of Ukraine because, and Russia, basically, so they can stop teaching this, so they can go on with their demonic green economy theory that they're pushing.
Yeah. Yeah. I find it interesting that Hunter Biden was on Burisma. Burisma is the biggest energy company in the Ukraine. The Ukraine is one of the foremost proponents of abiotic oil, you know, with Russia. Now, I don't know if Russia is trying to, you know, take the Ukraine oil, whether they're trying to, I mean, Russia doesn't care if this theory gets out. I think the Russians are the main proponents of this. They're looking at the West like idiots. What are you talking about fossil fuels? These aren't fossils at all. You know, the earth
I don't think Russia is trying. I don't think Russia is trying to take the Ukraine on. But you know, here's the thing too to mention. You know, when Eisenhower put in the interstate highway system, at that point in time, you had a lot of cities that was operating electric streetcars.
Yeah, I remember that.
And Albert Sloan, who was the CEO of General Motors.
Mm-hmm.
They wanted to do away with the electric streetcars and replace them with gasoline-powered vehicles like buses. Matter of fact, during the Montgomery bus boycott, it was the National City Lines, which was a product of General Motors, that the buses were being boycotted, you know, with Rosa Parks and so forth. So interesting history.
Well, yeah, there's something called the Snell Report, which you might want to read. I did a project on this in college. And the Snell Report documented how GM buses, Firestone tires, and Standard Oil, gasoline, conspired to get rid of all the electric streetcars and trolleys in the United States.
You're
and
absolutely really, right.
And they did it in Los Angeles especially. Los Angeles had the world's finest electric trolley system. All through the from the turn of the century up through the, I think the 40s. I think it was in the 50s they got rid of them. But up through the 40s, you can look up a map of the Los Angeles trolley system, and it went all over the L.A. basin. You could get anywhere by trolley. And they had the electricity, and I'm not sure how they had it, probably hydro power of the water coming down the mountains. But they had the electricity, and it was the cleanest, safest, best, most efficient public transit system probably anywhere in the world. Certainly the biggest.
And you know,
and
another
great
thing.
The buses suck. The trolleys were great. They got trolleys in San Francisco. They got a whole, they got trolleys from all over the world in San Francisco. It's one of the big attractions down, you go down Market Street and then the Embarcadero to Fisherman's Wharf. So from up to Castro, all the way down Market, and then left turn, you know, on Embarcadero to Fisherman's Wharf. You had trolleys from everywhere, like bunch of cities in the United States. You had Milan, Italy. You had, I think Zurich, Switzerland had one. You had this English open trolley.
It was
just
all
fascinating.
Over the place.
They had a Melbourne tram that I used
this
to ride to school. Yeah.
Did you know this? You know the curbs that you see on the streets?
Mm-hmm.
Those curb stones are about 2 foot tall originally. Now, when they had the rails in the street, the tracks for the streetcars to roll over,
mm-hmm.
the curb, the step up from the surface of the street to the curb was a chore. But what happened, and you see this today when you dig up the streets, you run into these tracks. A contractor has to put enough in to compensate for having to pull these tracks up. Well, these tracks have been covered to the point now where a curb is that's sticking up above the street is about 8 inches rather than the foot or so that it used to be. So there we go.
So you're saying the tracks are being more exposed now? Because I see tracks in the ground sometimes in the tar. You can see them exposed.
Whenever they excavate the streets, they mm-hmm. run into these old tracks that was used back during that period of time that you were mentioning.
Yeah, yeah. No, and they should actually put them back again. I mean, trolleys are – now they call them light rail, but the light rail is usually prohibitively expensive. It doesn't go where – the trolleys used to go bus lines. I mean, trolleys went everywhere. And in San Francisco, they had limited trolleys because the hills were so steep, but they kept cable cars. And the cable car runs by mm-hmm. literally grabbing onto a cable, you know, and they
– Yeah, it was like the continuous conveyor in the ground that they come up to and they grab a hold of and they pull it up the hill.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, yeah. In fact, the cable, the grip that actually grips onto the cable, because that cable keeps moving at about 14 miles an hour, those grips only last about 3 weeks. And they have to haul them out and put a new one in because the metal just wears apart. It's really pretty incredible. All right, let me get a little bit back here. We've got a few more of these. Well, I'll probably get these three done, and then I'm going to pick up. I've got like five more for tomorrow. This is just way too much fun. Here we go. This is how the scientific community deals with total repudiation of everything they espouse. Instead of following their findings to their ultimate and somewhat argue inevitable conclusion, they speak of them in isolation. What they do not mention, so I will, is that the existence of creatures that get their energy from hydrocarbons means there is an alternative explanation for the presence of organic elements within, quote, fossil fuels other than fossils, which is just what we talked about. This is what is more, the existence of oil seepage on the seafloor means that oil seepage is possible everywhere, including and obviously into and after having first formed existing shallow oil fields. Then he talks about just a couple more things on this article. And then he talks about methane. Methane is a hydrocarbon. It is a byproduct of biological matter, either directly or geologically. Okay. In other words, living matter is required. Methane exists on Saturn's moon. Methane exists on Saturn's moon, Titan, as well as in the atmospheres of Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune. Methane is the primary constituent of natural gas, a, quote, fossil fuel. Although the presence of methane in extraterrestrial environments does not of itself repudiate the biogenic theory, equally it does validate the abiogenic theory. In other words, it shows that squashed fish and other biological detritus are not prerequisites for the existence of such substances. If they are not prerequisites, then perhaps assuming they are was a hasty move, insisting they are is purely a business move. So in other words, yeah. So methane in all these different places, Saturn's moon, all these different places where it shouldn't exist, if methane as a hydrocarbon is a purely organic substance, then it wouldn't be out there in Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune. You know, why would it be there? Why would it be in asteroids? Why would it be in different places that it's not supposed to be if it's an organic compound? Well, it's not. It's made in all kinds of different places and apparently different planets. Anyway, he says, and he's got volume. He says, this is the biggest giveaway for me. According to a study by the University of Utah, it would have taken a staggering 98 tons of prehistoric buried plant material, that's 196,000 pounds, to produce each gallon of gasoline we burn in our cars, SUVs, trucks, and on and on. Can you imagine loading 40 acres worth of wheat, stalks, roots, and all into the tank of your car or SUV every 20 miles? Ask ecologist Jeff Dukes. Fossil fuel apologists will argue that the timescales their theory proposes, millions of years, more than explains the obvious mathematical anomaly here. But crucially, they don't explain how. They talk of oil as a one-off phenomenon formed over geological timescales, not as a conveyor belt of living forests dying, sinking, and being pressurized time after time. And their own calculations indicate that not only should oil be running scarce, it should be a thing of the past. Instead, we have newer, larger deposits being found almost weekly. What does it all mean? In a nutshell, to explain a newly discovered substance, an educated guess was made. That would be, that'd be the idea of fossil fuels. Two, analysis seems to confirm this hypothesis. Capitalism found a use for this substance, that'd be oil, an extremely lucrative one. Money ensured that the substance was codified and therefore rarefied. Five, confirmation bias and the propensity of humankind not to question did the rest. This is the few who dared question the theory are always on the back foot. Instead of weighing up the alternatives rationally and acting accordingly, in other words, establishing the merits of each theory and using them to further our understanding of quite possibly the most important single commodity on Earth after water, the scientific community does what it does best. It circles the wagons to defend orthodoxy. This is true in other fields, none more so than climate change, but also such topics as HIV/AIDS, where it is not unanimously accepted that the latter is a direct result of the former. It's a sooner or later the myth of peak oil will be exposed by the continued abundance of oil reserves and their constant replenishment. But history proves that capitalism won't be admitting anything anytime soon, and all the resources money can buy will be expended keeping the lie going as long as possible. Pretty cool stuff, huh? It's all a big lie, Pianki.
Yes, sir.
The whole thing. It's all being a big lie. Let me take a break real quick, play a couple things, and I'll be right back. Greg Penglis here for my book, The Complete Guide to Flight Instruction. Everyone at some point in their life wants to learn how to fly. Few try. Even fewer go on to get a license. I believe a major reason for that is how we teach people how to fly. My book is designed to help you navigate the flight training system, but it's so much more than that. It really describes an entirely new way to teach flying. So if you've never tried a lesson or got discouraged in your training and quit for any reason, this book can help you. Don't be a rote pilot who just follows procedures. Be a thinking pilot who makes great decisions, who understands all the reasons why we do what we do. You can incorporate these principles into your own flight training at any time. The Complete Guide to Flight Instruction is featured on the Action Radio with Greg Penglis Facebook page and is available from Amazon.com.
This is Greg Penglis for Strike Force, your source for pure energy. Strike Force is a concentrated energy drink that turns a half liter of your favorite beverage into an energy drink. It contains caffeine, taurine, B vitamins, and potassium. You make your energy drink yourself. Here's how. Add one pack to a standard half liter water bottle or 16 ounce glass to create a full power energy drink. No sugar, no calories, no stirring, no shaking. Strike Force energy drinks come in original, grape, lemon, and orange. Each flavor pack is a liquid that adds an explosion of flavor to any beverage. Here's the best part. Action Radio is an affiliate of Strike Force, so our listeners get a 20% discount. All you do is add our code WYL to the discount code window at checkout. That's W-Y-L. W-Y-L comes from our website, Write Your Laws. So, you can get your energy drink, get a 20% discount, and help Action Radio change the relationship of we the people to our government. Not bad. Strike Force is at StrikeForceEnergy.com. That's StrikeForceEnergy.com. Start your engines. Action Radio, part of the ADHD Radio Network, the ultimate free speech zone. We the people give our consent to be governed through writing the laws by which we are governed and have the power through juries to nullify the laws by which we do not consent to be governed. At Action Radio, we don't report the news. We are the news. Every other show reports what has happened. We talk about what can happen. From the questions no one has thought to ask, to the answers no one has thought to consider, to the actions no one has dared to take. That is Action Radio.
All right, we got just about 10 minutes before Dr. Peter Pry joins us. We'll find out the latest on Ukraine. I actually sent him the show title ahead of time, so I'm curious if he wants to weigh in on our oil thing. But Pianchi, let's just talk for a few minutes, because it's my continual fascination and disgust that people are so willing to believe things without question, that oil is about to run out, that the world population is going to kill us all, that the carbon dioxide, which is known plant food, is somehow dangerous, that federal land is really federal land, even though it was stolen from the states. You know, and people just believe all this stuff. And they don't question. They don't think about it. They're comfortable. It's almost like fear is a more comfortable condition. They'd rather be afraid of COVID than resist the government telling them they have to lock down, instead of saying, screw you, I'm not locking down. They're more comfortable fearing the end of, oil's, running out. We better, what are we going to do? Oh, no, we better buy electric cars. There's a fear out there that should be saying, hey, look, we know there's tons of oil. We know there's more oil than we know what to do with. Stop these ridiculous mandates, you idiots. Get the hell out of office. They should be rejecting all this. And I'd love to see a protest, around the White House. Brandon, get lost.
Well,
move. But they don't. People don't. They don't. They're comfortable in their fear. They'd rather be afraid and worry than enjoy, a life of plenty that we've got here. They just don't want the good life. It's weird. I don't understand.
Well, see, what the problem is that the Constitution don't give the federal government that authority to own what they call federal land.
That's
it's
right.
Only very detailed and specific what they are allowed to own. So what they're claiming is really the land of the states.
Mm-hmm.
Once again, the federal government gets its powers from the states, not the other way around.
Yeah, but, I mean, the power is either taken, usually power is, there's two parts to power. There's the taking of power and there's the granting of power. They usually work together. So in other words, for the federal government to take power over state land, the states have to let them. Well, there's no reason for the states to let them. It's just,
the states believe, and people believe that the federal government is the God principle. They really do. You should hear, test this theory out and just ask people and see what they say.
Yeah, it's the Supreme Court. It was a name, but it's not. The federal separation is an equal share of power in different areas. The government has the nation's borders. Because if you are Supreme Court, they got going on there, but there are areas that are reserved to the states, education, energy, health, all that kind of stuff. And so those are the things that need to go back to the states, or certainly they just need to be diversified or dissolved in Washington. But people don't get it. The federal government is not supreme. You even see on the TV shows, the federal agent walks, the FBI guy walks in. Well, we're taking over. We're the FBI. Well, screw you. Who cares? Unless they have jurisdiction there. And the FBI really, what are the federal crimes? Treason, bribery, and counterfeiting, right? Aren't those the federal crimes? The real federal crimes, not the ones that they've taken on. But as far as I know, the only federal crimes are treason, bribery, and counterfeiting.
Well, it should be
right?
Counterfeiting.
Well, counterfeiting, that's
it should be treason.
You'd
be a Benedict Arnold.
Yeah. Yeah. It's kind of funny. He started off as a pretty good officer, too, and definitely lost his way, though. Idiot. I hate traitors. But
did you imagine what type of changes we would be looking at if the states were to take back their land?
Oh, well, I'm proposing they do. And don't ask the feds. Don't talk to the feds. Just do it. Just give them notice. Say, okay, we're going to give you 10 days to pack up your toys and go home. And they can scream and all they want. Well, this is our land. Well, it's not your land. Prove it's your land. Go ahead. And you can't. So the states, like I say, my fear is that they would ask the feds permission. Oh, please leave our land. Oh, please, let's take it to the Supreme Court. Let's negotiate it. Let's do this. And, of course, the Supreme Court, being a government agency, would rule as the federal government wants them to rule. And they'd say, oh, no, I'm sorry. This is really federal land. There's an exception to the rule. It's called the we've been here long enough principle. Or they'd make something up. Well, we've been here for 100 years and you didn't object, so therefore common law, it becomes federal, which would be a bunch of BS. But they might argue something like that.
Didn't you mention something? Don't the Constitution mention something about forts?
Yeah, yeah. I'll give you the exact quote. It's Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17. Ooh, you like the way I just ripped that right out? I looked up last
week. You know what forts those were, don't you?
Forts to kill
the
Indians.
It was an F troop type force. Remember?
Yeah, we're the Hakawi. You know, remember the Indian tribe, the Hakawi. In other words, where the heck are we, the Hakawi? Where the heck are we? Oh, really?
But that's what they were. The fort that they built in the Western Plains. Absolutely. Yeah.
No, that was the joke, because where the heck are we? You know, because there is no Indian nation called the Hakawi. You know, it's where the heck are we? You know, that was the joke. All right. Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17. To exercise exclusive legislation in all cases whatsoever over such district, and you know what I'm talking about, that would be D.C., not exceeding 10 miles square, as may by cession, that would be taking a portion of particular states and the acceptance of Congress, become the seat of government of the United States. Okay, so the seat of government of the United States, for those who don't know what I'm talking about, is Washington, D.C. Washington, D.C. is not more than 10 square miles, and it was taken from, by cession, portions of Maryland and Virginia. That's where it is, all right? So that's the first part of the clause. The second part says, and to exercise like authority, in other words, exclusive jurisdiction, over all places purchased by the consent of the legislature of the state. Okay? So in other words, unless the federal government can prove a bill of sale, you know, saying that they purchased land with the permission, the consent of the legislature, then they have no claim to that land. None whatsoever. All right? And of the state which the same shall be. And what was the purpose of that? For the erection of forts, magazines, arsenals, dockyards, assuming you're on water, and other needful buildings. Well, that's kind of general, other needful buildings. But unless it's a government building with permission of the state to purchase the land under those buildings, the federal government has no claim to it. The only claim they have is D.C. and certain forts, magazines, arsenals, and dockyards. That's it.
And it shouldn't be purchased. It should be leased.
Well, we don't know what it says, but it says to the exercise like authority over all places purchased by the – well, this is what the Constitution says. So in other words, the federal government, if they purchased land in a state with the consent of the legislature – consent implies that it wasn't coerced or extorted.
Well, what I'm saying is the legislature don't have to agree to a purchase. They could just say, well, we don't want to sell it.
No,
we'll let you lease it.
Yeah, they could do that too. Yeah, consent. Consent implies that you can accept the sale, you can refuse the sale, you can make a new kind of sale, you can make it conditional. I mean, that's what consent is. So however they consent, they can't be coerced or extorted, and they certainly can't be forced. So that is, in fact, state land. So all that land out west, folks, you know, from Montana to New Mexico to Arizona, Nevada to Oregon, Washington, and California, all that land that the feds are currently illegally occupying is state land. And none of that state land is oil, natural gas, uranium, and other, you know, vital minerals that belong to the population, the people of that state. That's who it belongs to. That's why Alaska gets royalties for their oil, because that oil belongs to the people of Alaska. So the oil companies pay them for it. Well, if the states realize they could make a whole bunch of money, you know,
the same thing should apply to offshore oil wells drilling too. Exploration.
Well, here's a question.
Those revenues should go back to the states.
How far, like the Gulf of Mexico, for example, how far?
I think it's 20 miles. I'm not sure.
State jurisdiction, 20 miles.
Yeah, I think it's 20 miles, but I'm not sure.
Okay. So oil wells beyond 20 miles, would they be in international waters?
They would be in international water.
But water that's within a state. Oil wells, that are the big ones would be Texas and Louisiana. I think Mississippi has oil wells.
Texas, Louisiana,
too.
Georgia.
No, Georgia doesn't have oil wells. Georgia's not.
Well, I'm
either.
Talking about offshore.
Does Georgia have wells? That would be off the Atlantic coast.
I don't know. Yeah, you know, they sit there on the Atlantic Ocean. Any state that sit on the ocean, if you got that type of activity that's producing revenue, then the state should be able to receive the benefits of that revenue rather than going to leasing fees to the federal government.
Well, the other thing, too, is maritime law. The fishing limit is 200 miles. So I don't know how far. I'm going to look up that for a mile. So state jurisdiction, oil leases in the Gulf.
But the thing is could you imagine how better off a state would be as far as providing whatever it chose to with that type of revenue additionally than what it has now?
Excuse me. I mean, but look how much better we'd be if we didn't have leftists. You know, let's just look at three issues. One, the states would have their land back from the feds. Okay, but that's not really a left or right issue. But that's a government power issue. But look how much better we'd be if the states took their land back. It's their land. Look how much better off we'd be if we collectively rejected the whole climate change theory and said, no, you're not going to tax us. No, you're not going to put us in a box. You're not going to regulate us. You're not going to take away our single-family homes and the single-family home zoning. You're not going to take away our cars. There's no reason to. There is no climate change that's brought about by human beings. There just isn't.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Is the Earth warming?
Here.
Well, apparently the Earth actually is warming up a little bit, which it tends to do between ice ages. Okay? That's the difference. And it tends to cool for ice ages and tends to warm between ice ages. That's why the most productive times in the history of all of us is been this particular break between the last ice age and hopefully the next one, which comes long past when I'm gone, because I don't want to be around for it. But
where's Peter?
I don't know. He's a couple minutes late. That's okay. We'll give him a chance. If he doesn't show up, I've got a whole bunch more articles to talk about. Oh, there he is. See, you say something and there he is. It's just. It happened just that fast. But just to sum up for Dr. Pryor, if he wants to comment on this at all, like I say, last week, it's been 2 hours. That state land, the feds have taken state land, and they're calling it federal land, and it's simply not. The second one, CO2, is good for the environment. It's good for plants. It's good for us. We can take a much higher, many times higher level of carbon dioxide than we have right now. 350 million parts per million right now, we could do with 2,000 parts per million. And we'd have the greenest earth and the most productive and the most food. We wouldn't have food problems, okay? And the third thing that we're talking about this week is that oil is not a fossil fuel. Well, maybe some of it is. But the earth simply makes it. It combines the chemicals under the earth, under heat and pressure in the mantle, and the stuff bubbles up. And it's especially in the Gulf of Mexico, they're finding all these wells that they drilled previously. I got articles, I'll have that for tomorrow, that there's a bunch of, this is like all these wells in the Gulf that they thought they were done, and then they come back a few years later and they're full of oil again. So how'd that happen? Anyway, we're going to talk to Dr. Pry about Ukraine and everything else that's going on. But those are the three big things. The federal land is actually state land. CO2 is good for the environment. It's not a pollutant and it's not a contributor to global warming. The earthworms first. Earth warms first, and then CO2 increases. We got to get those straight. And fossil fuels, that's a joke. Don't believe it for a second. All right, let's get to Pryon.
And I'm going to leave
because
Peter coming up. I'm going to say this about Russia.
Okay.
Russia, Putin, is allowed to have what's called post-traumatic World War II syndrome. And they're very, very, very nervous when they see their borders being threatened and missiles pouring out. Now, I'm going to tell you why that should be. Because you hear people talking about what, Greg? That black people have post-slavery traumatic syndrome.
Well, that's kind of long-lasting, don't you think? I don't believe that for a second, but that's just
yeah,
just
but
me.
It has to happen. Does not a battered spouse have that sort of fear when a husband come around?
That's a direct experience.
You got
the folks that are talking about slavery.
You had one gentleman that was running from the police, being chased by a car, and he said he feared that if the white police caught him, they would kill him. So Russia is allowed to have post-traumatic World War II syndrome and what they experienced with the Germans.
Well, I've said, as a lot of folks have said, that one of the biggest problems with Ukraine and Russia is that the neocons, the warmongers, the permanent war class, did everything possible to push Putin into a conflict by simply trying to make every possible country around Russia a NATO country, which was stupid on its face. It never should have happened. I wouldn't
That's
even let
what I'm
Poland
talking
into
about.
NATO. Yeah, exactly.
Yes, they're nervous. What they've went through, they're nervous.
No, let's ask Dr. Pry about it. But as I said, there are three reasons that Russia's nervous about the West. You know, Napoleon, Bismarck, and Hitler. And so that's how it all worked out. All right, let's get to Dr. Pry.
Thank you.
What is national security? How much is enough? What about the cost? What are our adversaries doing? Who wins between the State Department and the Pentagon? How accurate is our intelligence capability? Are we keeping up with our nuclear deterrent? Do we have better weapons than our adversaries? How would we know? Can we withstand an EMP attack? How is our missile defense? How about the basic power grid? Is it safe? These are the questions Dr. Pry has been dealing with his whole career. Dr. Peter Vincent Pry is the Executive Director of the Task Force on National and Homeland Security. He has served on the Congressional EMP Commission, the Congressional Strategic Posture Commission, the House Armed Services Committee, and the CIA. He is the author of The Power and the Light, the Congressional EMP Commission's War to Save America. And now he anchors the National Security Report here on Action Radio. How much national security is enough? And now, Dr. Peter Vincent Pry.
Yeah, maybe I should add Kaiser Wilhelm to that group, too. I'm not sure exactly how far Bismarck went into Russia, if he did, but I'm pretty sure Kaiser Wilhelm didn't in World War I. Good morning, sir. For this and other light topics.
it's been quite a morning so far.
Yeah.
Well, von Bismarck didn't invade Russia, but Kaiser Wilhelm did. The Mongols did. The Ottoman Turks did. Gustavus Adolphus, there was such a thing called the Swedish Empire, did. You could just go on and on in terms of their history, as long as we know their history. And I'm sure that there were, if you go back to the before 1000 AD, which is basically the Dark Ages Russia, where we don't really have much of a recorded history, there were, I'm sure there were invasions by various, barbarian groups, after all, that ended up destroying the Roman Empire. They had to come from somewhere. And a lot of them came, from the steppes and from that part of the world. In fact, you can even go back to Herodotus, one of the, I don't want to waste their time on this, but
Herodotus
claims.
I like ancient history. It puts things in perspective, so feel free.
Back in the ancient Greek world, around 400 BC, around the time of when Herodotus was writing, the Russians were known as the Sarmatians, and they were fierce, warlike people. Because according to Herodotus, during the Trojan War, the Amazons helped. We're on the side of the Trojans. And when they were defeated, the Greeks captured a lot of the Amazons, and they were bringing them back as prisoners to Greece. But the Amazon women managed to take over a couple of the galleys and landed in the area of Crimea, the northern Black Sea area, what the Greeks called Sarmatia, and basically became the wives of these proto-Russian tribes. And that's why the Russians have been so warlike. The new Russian heavy ICBM, by the way, is named after them. It's called the Sarmat. Harkens back to these early ferocious warriors who were so feared by the Greeks. But I don't have a lot of time this morning because I've got to go at around 9:30, 9:40. So don't let me go past that. I'll try to watch the clock myself.
I'll tell you about 20 minutes. I'll give you a little warning. Yeah. So of where we are.
Thank you. Right. I like what Pianki said before. I've often said it myself on the radio. It's just that his idea about post-traumatic World War II syndrome is just another way of saying that Russia has a very different strategic culture than ours. Mm-hmm. And to us, it may seem, and you can just see it in the unsophistication of our Western analysts and media elites who are condemning Putin as crazy and a madman and everything that he's doing, when in fact it's just differently rational because they have such a different history, such a bloody history compared to ours. And that's I've never heard that described as post-traumatic syndrome, you know, but yeah.
I didn't either, but it makes sense.
It's a product of their history, where if you had a history like Russia has had, it isn't irrational for them to think that when you're bringing in Ukraine as a Partnership for Peace member and Tajikistan and Kazakhstan and all these former Soviet territories that surround Russia, that they're going to not be happy about that and look at the worst case scenario from that perspective. Now, having said that, you know, one of the flaws I think in our strategic culture is our inability to get past to have to look at everything through a moral lens. So there are always good guys and bad guys. And so people end up defending Russia and Putin and saying, well, that's understandable, and almost turning him into a good guy. You know, objectivity, really, it's a mixture of both. You know, I mean, that's the reality. And on balance, Putin is an evil guy and Russia is an evil empire. But even evil guys and evil empires have legitimate interests, you know. And the reason Russia is invading Ukraine is for a mix of legitimate and illegitimate interests. Yes, they see Ukraine membership in NATO, and frankly, the reaction of the West by arming up Ukraine and doing everything but jumping in with their own troops at this point would appear to justify to the Russian general staff and Putin and his advisors their fear that Ukraine was well on its way to becoming a NATO member state, because they were concerned not only with Ukraine becoming officially a member of NATO, but a de facto member state. And that's a lot like our policy toward Ukraine is seeming to verify those worst concerns, which is going to make the Russians fight all the harder because they probably feel they're right based on the Western reaction. So they've got – Russia has – legitimate defensive concerns, but they also have illegitimate aggressive designs for going into Ukraine. Now, this is the evil empire part, you know, because they want to put us in the, if they take over Ukraine, you know, they'll be able to move their armies and missiles and air forces to the West and reconstitute the kind of threat that the Soviet Union posed during the Cold War. And that's not a good thing either. You know, that's obviously a threat to us. But on balance, you know, what is the main question should be, if you're thinking in terms of, if you believe in an America first foreign policy, if you believe in a foreign policy driven by American national interests and not globalist national interests, what is the case for America getting involved in the Ukrainian conflict, supporting Ukraine, taking an enormous risk, because it's not a small thing. It's an enormous existential risk we're taking when we're dealing with a nuclear superpower like Russia that has nuclear superiority over us at every level and that has put its forces on alert even as we speak. What interest is it worth risking the destruction of the United States in a nuclear war over Ukraine? And that's the position Biden has put us in, because he's blundered into this position. And now,
who's behind it? Who do you think's really behind? Because Biden's not doing anything. I mean, no, he's a metal moron. So who do you think's the neocons, the permanent war class? If you had some people to name it, this doesn't sound State Department. This sounds more warmonger class. Who do you think's really behind a lot of this?
Well, I think we talked about this on a previous show, but it's worth reprising since Who knows where this could go? I think there's a number of layers. I think Biden has a direct personal interest because his family was enriched by the relationship with Ukraine. And I think Biden is the most corrupt president we've ever had. Well, maybe he's at least on a par with Bill Clinton as a corrupt president, where he's sold his office. He sold his office to enrich himself. And and if he failed to do anything about protecting Ukrainian sovereignty, that would make his credibility, go down in terms of being somebody worth bribing. The Ukrainians thought they were buying security by giving money to Biden, and now he's on the hook to do something about it. But that doesn't explain why NATO and the Republicans and the Democrats have closed ranks, behind this idea that we need to jump in there and do everything we can to support Ukraine. And I think that's because they're globalists. It's the same ideological thing that brought us into Afghanistan and Iraq, into Vietnam. I mean, since 1945, and even before that, we call it globalism today, but it's basically Wilsonian idealism, except subtract God and replace God with secular humanism is the value system. And that's what globalism is today. At least Wilson was motivated by a belief in the universality of the desire for freedom as a God-given kind of motive that would be in every human heart. That is certainly absent from the globalist belief system today. But the idea of that nationalism is evil, the problems of the world, the wars are caused by nationalism, patriotism, and we need to get past that. We need to evolve the world past that to a one-world order that's dominated and run. You can still have nations, but they're going to be sort of like the relationship that the states have to Washington, D.C., subordinate to supranational institutions. In Wilson's case, it was the League of Nations. Today, it's the United Nations. Concepts of international law. You'll often find these people talking about normative behaviors in international relations, which is just a way of saying everybody's got to obey the international laws that we in the West have come up with that are derived from our Judeo-Christian roots, although we want to forget about the Judeo and the Christian part of those roots and just have this idea that, it's going to be regulated by international laws, by the international courts at The Hague, by supranational institutions like NATO. And even though you, China and Russia and the rest of the world haven't had anything to do with building these institutions, if you're civilized, you're going to go along with us and adopt our superior worldview and get away from your troglodyte nationalist way of looking at the world and overcome your own histories. And it's obviously a fantasy. It's an impossible thing, but that's what we've been trying to do. And it seemed plausible at one time in the aftermath of World War II because the United States was controlled. We had such an enormous economy relative to the whole world, and we were ahead of everybody technologically and in terms of our military power. And the globalists, decided to use the U.S. as the world policeman, appealing to nationalist instincts like patriotism to get people to support the globalist agenda, to fight wars that didn't make sense to the American people if you thought of it from an America First nationalist perspective. But the globalist elites promised us, oh, we're defending democracy here, so we've got to do it. We've got to send our boys to die in these far-flung, obscure places, both to stop communism and to support democracy. And some of those things were necessary, but, and made sense. Like, I think the Vietnam War, even though we ended up losing it, was a legitimate thing. But let's. I don't want to get it sidetracked by getting over to Vietnam War again. You know, but the point is, this is why we're in Ukraine, why it doesn't make sense. And the only thing you can hear, and I heard it from Republicans today while I was watching Fox News, was, well, we've got to get in there to defend democracy and stop this war criminal Putin from, you know, breaking international law and violating the sovereignty of nations, which is, as Tucker Carlson constantly points out, you know, why is it that we're supposed to be more concerned about the sovereignty of Ukraine than we are with the sovereignty of the United States?
Yeah, or,
you know,
our own
why
border.
Are we supposed to be more concerned with Ukrainian borders?
Yep.
You know, we are willing to risk a nuclear war over Ukrainian borders, but we leave our own borders wide open. Well, that doesn't make any sense logically if you look at it from an America First nationalist perspective, but it's perfectly rational from the globalist perspective, who ultimately wants to erase these national borders and impose the secular humanist LGBTQ woke values of the West, of the Western elites. I saw this happening when I had the NATO enlargement portfolio, when I was on the House Armed Services Committee. I wasn't even aware of it, and, you know, it was my specialty. But one of the things that was happening, and I found this out when they sent me to places like Latvia and Estonia and Lithuania and Poland and Romania, countries that weren't in NATO yet but wanted to come into NATO. And over again, I heard complaints from their military political leaders that, you know, that the European Union, that had a vote, it wasn't just the United States, but the European Union and the Western European countries, of course, had a vote on whether a country could come into NATO. And apparently our diplomats, well, maybe our diplomats were aware of it, but these people, their spokesmen, made me aware of it when I was in these countries, that they were interested in having these countries that had traditionalist values, much more religious, didn't subscribe to the LGBTQ agenda, that they
like
had changed that.
Like
they had
Poland.
They had to embrace gay marriage, right? You know, they had to take on all the radical feminist agenda as a precondition for them being allowed into NATO. And so, you know, the left was able to leverage that, you know, to force these countries, you know, to adopt a left-wing social values, or at least say that they would, and take some kind of concrete legal measures to indicate that they were changing the evil ways of being, you know, of supporting the traditional kinds of values and concepts that had been around, well, since the human species evolved until recent times, and we discovered, you know, secular humanism was superior to Christianity as a value system. But all of that is so there's two reasons for us being in Ukraine, at least, you know, and one of them, I think, is just the fact that the Biden administration feels it owes it to Ukraine, President Biden personally, because of the bribery that went on. The larger thing, the thing that always gets us into these situations, wars that don't really serve America's interests, is the globalist ideology. What I had really wanted to talk to you about, though, was just the fact that this threat, the nuclear threat, is so real and isn't being really talked about. Everybody's so enthusiastic to jump in here. But last Sunday, February, not this past Sunday, but the Sunday before that, February 27th, you know, Putin put his nuclear forces on a special combat alert and went down into one of his deep underground command posts, nuclear command and control command posts, and he's still there, and the alert hasn't been lifted. And then shortly after that, on March 8th, we had Avril Haines, who's our top spy, America's top intelligence officer, so-called, She's the director of the National Intelligence. She and the rest of the intelligence community briefed Congress. I think that was last Tuesday. I'm pretty sure, whatever March 8th was, and basically said, don't worry about this so-called special nuclear forces alert that Putin went to and all these nuclear threats the Russians are making. It's just bluster and bluffing, you know, because we have been carefully watching Russia's strategic posture, and we don't see them sending ballistic missile submarines to sea or mobilizing their bomber force or sending their mobile ICBMs to the field in any numbers that are greater than they have in normal times. And therefore, you know, don't worry about these nuclear threats. It's all just basically bluster and bluffing from Putin. And they tend to say that's the typical thing that the West usually says whenever the Chinese make a nuclear threat, whenever the North Koreans make a nuclear threat. It's always bluster and bluffing, according to them. And I've written an article called hasn't been published yet. Been trying to get it published. Surprisingly, I haven't been able to get it published yet, but I will soon. Called the Nuclear 9/11 in Our Future. You know, referencing the catastrophic intelligence failure that resulted in 9/11, and trying to remind people that our intelligence community has had a long, including a recent record of catastrophic intelligence failures. And I think that this is another one, you know, because they either know or they're lying about the elevated threat of a nuclear war, and they're trying to protect Biden's reputation. They don't want another Afghanistan to embarrass the president. And I think they don't want to be put in a position to have to say what U.S. national interests are so vital that it's worth getting a nuclear war with Russia, you know? And so they would like to make this nuclear threat go away. And I point out the technical reasons why Avril Haines is wrong and the intelligence community is wrong about their assessment that Putin is just bluffing. You know, a lot of what they say reflects, again, they're either lying to the American people and misrepresenting things, or maybe they've gotten so incompetent that they don't really understand Russia's strategic nuclear posture and how their system works and the conditions under which we're supposed to be concerned about an elevated threat of nuclear war. And by the way, I have to add, you know, when I was at the CIA, one of my jobs, I worked very closely with the National Intelligence Officer for Strategic Warning. And I got a special, unique award from them for my expert analysis and improvement of our ability to look at indicators of the increasing threat of nuclear war. Although maybe I don't deserve that reward because it doesn't seem to have taken the lessons, don't seem to have taken, or maybe they've been forgotten by the current crop of people in the intelligence community. But let me just step through, if I could, you know, before we run out of time, just step through reasons we should be concerned and that Putin is not bluffing. First of all, and this one is just so obvious that even a child should understand it, but one of the most fundamental indications and warning facts that people need to be aware of is the occurrence of a major conventional war in Europe that involves the nuclear superpowers. You know, under Indications and Warning 101, that immediately is supposed to trip the alarms and say, wow, you've got a major conventional war in Europe in which Russia and the United States are involved. Mm-hmm. So that means right there you've got an elevated risk of a nuclear war, of a nuclear confrontation. And that is obviously happening, and we see it every day on the television. The other major indicator is that Putin declares that he's putting his forces on alert and then goes down to a nuclear command and control bunker, you know, because he is the dictator of Russia. He's their national command authority. You know, it's the height of irresponsibility you know, when he's warned you in that way, to say, ah, don't worry about it. He's just bluffing. I mean, that would be like ignoring Hitler or Stalin or Mao or anyone who's made such threats. You've given his background. He's the National Command Authority. He's also a former KGB thug, a megalomaniac, and a proven killer. It would be like if you knew you lived next door to a psychotic and the guy pointed a pistol at you one day and said, you know, I'm thinking about shooting you in the head, and just waving that away and saying, he's just bluffing. I'm not even going to worry about that. It's that irresponsible. But there are other technical reasons, for one thing, that make that threat credible, and that is that the Russian strategic posture, the posture of their nuclear forces, is very different from ours. You know, our triad is of missile submarines and bombers and ICBMs is designed for transparency and what the arms control community calls strategic stability. It's not designed for being able to launch a surprise attack against an adversary. And one of the ways we posture our forces, so it's not designed for a surprise attack, at least not a large-scale disarming surprise attack, is we rely less heavily on ICBMs than we do on ballistic missile submarines. You know, we've got 1,500 warheads, and only 400 of them are on ICBMs that are on a high alert rate all the time. Most of our warheads are on ballistic missile submarines, and the rest of them, in fact, more weapons than our ICBMs are on bombers. And the ballistic missile submarines are mostly in port all the time. They can't hit Russia from port because they carry intermediate-range ballistic missiles, so they have to go to sea. And our bombers take 3 days to generate. And we've done that to ourselves on purpose because under arms control theory, we want our posture to be transparent to the Russians and Chinese and everybody else so they can see we're not getting ready to make a surprise attack. And it's also it gives us the ability to do what's called political signaling, so that if we did want to react in a way that was threatening, you know, we could start mobilizing our bombers and mobilizing our submarines and sending submarines to sea to put a scare into them or to warn them off. You know, the Russians are very different. They're just the opposite in terms of their strategic posture. As we talked about before, they have this post-traumatic World War II Mongolian invasion, Napoleon and Hitler, Gustavus Adolphus syndrome. World War II in particular, their country was almost destroyed by Operation Barbarossa, which was a massive surprise attack by Hitler and the Nazis. And fundamental to their strategic culture is this desire to not only never be taken by surprise again, but be the ones who are going to be launching the surprise attack. Yeah. And they're the ones that want to strike first. And so they have configured their strategic forces to do exactly that. They rely almost exclusively on intercontinental ballistic missiles. Even their ballistic missile submarines have ICBMs on them. So they can reach the United States from port. And they have command and control arrangements, you know, so that they can secretly elevate the readiness of these forces to launch. Not that they need to be elevated that much. It's really a matter of basically taking 3.5 minutes to put in unlocking codes and adjusting the targeting, and then they can go. You can launch them. It's called constant combat readiness.
I just gave you the hotel because we're just a little bit past the bottom of the hour, and I wanted to ask you about the different levels. If we have like 5 minutes between the Russian constant combat readiness and our DEFCON system, something you sent me, which I found fascinating.
Sure, constant combat readiness, makes them capable of launching a surprise attack all the time, 24/7, and so. That's not why one of the most important indicators is what Putin says and does. And when he postures himself in a command post, he's 3.5 minutes away from being able to execute massive disarming first strike, a surprise attack against the United States. And historically, when they have made such threats that we assess are credible, you know, we raise the readiness of our forces so that we're not taken by surprise. And that's one of the things that the huge chances, I think it's unprecedented, the chance that Biden has taken here, justified by Avril Haines and this bogus story that the intelligence community gave last Tuesday, you know, because we've left our readiness level at DEFCON 5, which is the lowest readiness level.
Yeah, they don't have a DEFCON 5. They're like DEFCON 3.
They're constant combat ready.
Yeah,
they're
ready to go.
One of the mistakes people make is that their constant combat readiness is equivalent to our DEFCON 5. That is not true, because most of their forces are ICBMs. You know, they're much closer. And the reason, and they've also only got four levels of mobilization: constant combat readiness, increased combat readiness, threat of war readiness, and then full combat readiness. Increased combat readiness entails, you know, increased command, control, communications, intelligence readiness, like Putin going down into the nuclear command and control center.
Yeah, that's where they are now, right?
And maybe
increase?
Right. Starting to mobilize some of those forces which are not already mobilized. And then threat of war readiness means that that everything has pretty much been brought up and is ready for war because nuclear war is imminent. And then at full combat readiness, you're actually in nuclear war. We have five levels, and they know that we have five levels. And the reason they have four levels is to beat us to the nuclear draw. And they're trying to beat us to the nuclear draw at every level, including at the first level, at constant combat readiness, because our DEFCON 5 is nothing like constant combat readiness for the reasons that I explained earlier. You know, they have many more warheads, even if they're not violating the Arms Control Treaty. You know, they have about 3 to 4 times as many nuclear weapons that they could throw at us in 3.5 minutes than we have that we could throw back at them in 3.5 minutes. Most of their warheads are always ready. Most of ours are not, and we have to mobilize our forces in order to match that. We have to get up to like DEFCON 2, I think, in order to basically pose an equivalent threat to them. And we've never gone to DEFCON 1, which would mean full mobilization of all our forces, like sending all the submarines to sea and having all the bomber forces mobilized. We've never done that in any crisis. I think the highest we've gotten was DEFCON 2 during the Cuban Missile Crisis. So the nuclear threat nobody knows, I think, is another article I wrote on this very thing.
That's where I found these. Yeah, the differences in the levels. Yeah, but
And this idea that this fiction that we are not at an increased threat of nuclear war from Russia right now, you know.
But we're always at a threat. We're always an increased threat because their constant combat readiness. The word "constant" is one that jumps out at me. You know, that's like our DEFCON 3. It's like they're always at DEFCON 3. So they're always ahead of where we are. We have a completely relaxed state. They don't have a relaxed state. They don't have a normal everyday readiness when there is no threat of war. They're always under threat of war, according to the chart here of constant increased threat of war and full combat readiness. I mean,
don't need to send submarines to sea to achieve that increased readiness level because their submarines have ICBMs. So they can launch them right from port, so they don't need to send the submarines to sea. And if the submarines that are out there at sea, there are underground cables in the Sea of Husk in what are called the bastion areas. When they go send their ballistic missile submarines to sea, they usually don't go out into the broad Pacific or Atlantic because they're afraid that we could launch a surprise attack and attack them with their attack submarines. They have these very heavily defended bastion areas in the White Sea and the Sea of Husk, where they keep their ballistic missile submarines usually on patrol. And at the bottom of the ocean in these areas, they have cables. So even the submarines at sea can hook into the cables and secretly get messages for emergency action messages to launch or to increase their preparations without Avril Haines being aware of it. You know, the mobile ICBMs that she pointed to. Oh, we don't see them sending mobile ICBMs to the field, at least not in greater numbers than they normally do. Well, they don't have to if they're going to launch a surprise attack. That's because the mobile missiles that are in their garages, the garages have retractable roofs. They can retract the roofs in less than a minute and launch their mobile ICBMs right from the garages. As for the bombers, those would have to be mobilized, you know, but they probably would, if they were planning a surprise attack, they would probably deliberately not mobilize them, you know, hoping that she would draw the wrong conclusion. I'm getting, looks like I have to go.
Yeah,
so,
you got to go.
Thank you so much for having me again.
Yeah.
Okay.
No, I appreciate it.
Bye-bye.
Well, I'm really glad to cover this last little bit on these two different readinesses because it's the whole psychology of war, who's ready and at what level. And they're always at a higher level of readiness. It's just quite interesting. All right, sir. Thank you very much. Here we go. So Dr. Pryor had to leave. And so we'll do it again next week. Yeah. That was really interesting. And so just to go over it so folks understand what we're talking about here. This is an article. I think he's already written it, The Nuclear Crisis Nobody Knows. And so you look at the Russian readiness, and we sort of went over it a little bit. And the first one is called Constant Combat Readiness, which is normal everyday readiness when there is no threat of war. But when they say constant combat readiness, that's not, you know, relaxed combat readiness. They're ready to go. They're constantly ready, even though they say there's no threat of war, but they're still ready to go just in case. You know, it's quite interesting. The next level is increased combat readiness, increased readiness of command, control, communications. Those are like C3, I guess they call it, and partial mobilization of nuclear forces when there is an elevated risk of nuclear war. That's where they are now, increased combat readiness. So they've got the Putin's in the bunker. You know, the nuclear weapons are, you know, I guess being brought into targeting whatever else they're doing with them. Next one is threat of war readiness. All nuclear forces mostly are fully mobilized because there's an imminent threat of nuclear war. And when they're talking about nuclear war, that's a big one. That's not a local tactical, you know, that's a strategic nuclear war. And then, of course, full combat readiness. They keep using the word readiness. I think they use the word readiness like action. It says all nuclear forces are fully ready and or engaged in combat operations waging nuclear war. So they're in nuclear war at full combat readiness. That's how they describe it. Now, our DEFCON system is very different. And so DEFCON 5, normal everyday readiness when there is no threat of war. So they don't have a no threat of war. You know, they have there's this constant combat readiness. They say there, well, it says when there's no threat of war, but if they're constantly ready, that's a higher state of alert. We don't have an equivalent of that, not DEFCON 5. Our normal everyday readiness, when there's no threat of war, there's no readiness. It looks like that's DEFCON 5. DEFCON 4, increased intelligence surveillance of adversaries and increased base security. That's still less than the Russians do on a normal basis. You know, so what's normal intelligence surveillance? I mean, what do they do on a regular basis, right? DEFCON 3, mobilization of nuclear forces for combat operations. That's where they seem to be now. Russia's either at DEFCON 3 or at a higher level. You know, and the next one, DEFCON 2, nuclear forces ready for war in less than 6 hours. Well, they're ready. They're most relaxed state. They're ready for nuclear war in 3 minutes. Big difference. You know, we have to get to DEFCON 2 to get, you know, ready for war in less than 6 hours. And they're, again, their combat readiness, their constant combat readiness, their normal state is about 3 minutes from, you know, order to launch. And then of course the last one, DEFCON 1, all nuclear forces are fully ready and or engaged in combat operations waging nuclear war. So DEFCON 1's war. Anyway, I found it fascinating. And so those are the different levels of Russian readiness versus our readiness. Let's take a little break. We're going to have about 15 minutes when we come back. Have some fun, chat, talk about stuff, and play for a while. We've got a little bit of extra time for some things. Let's play something encouraging from the Biden insurrection.
Joe Biden's Dark Winter. No freedom, no liberty, no guns, no representation, no oil, no coal, no nuclear power, no space force, no constitution, no family gatherings, no vacations, just taxes, work, misery, masks, lockdowns, and ever more government. This is what will happen if you let Marxists steal.
steal the election. This has been a public service announcement of Action Radio, reminding you it's time to get off your butt and save your country. This is Greg Penglis for Action Radio. You've all heard those ads for people who have suffered medical or health tragedies, which say you may be entitled to compensation. But if you have suffered injuries or crippling diseases or medical procedures that went horribly wrong, it's not the compensation you need, it's the knowledge you should have had before the condition you suffer from now. So that you are never in that position in the future, I strongly recommend that you do not get any COVID vaccines. Get informed. Do your own research. For 99.97% of Americans, your natural immunity will give you, at worst, only moderate symptoms of COVID. If you've already had COVID, it's virtually impossible to get it again. There are effective cures for COVID, which will get you completely over the virus. There is no cure for the COVID-19 vaccines. Once you start down the road of DNA modification, there is no going back. This is Greg Penglis. So what is Action Radio? It is a radio show with its own citizen legislature. That's you, the listener. It is a fully interactive system of listeners, expert guests, social media, writing bills, legislator input, bill submission, lobbying, and citizen action. Action Radio is the future of talk radio, using all the available technology in one completely integrated new system. So I'm looking into what's going on, you know, with the oil. We'll continue tomorrow. I think it's going to be some fascinating things to talk about. We only have about 13 minutes left right now. But I found an article. I'm trying to find the connection between Burisma, the Bidens, abiotic oil, you know, different things like that. And there's nothing really obvious. I mean, this is going to take some digging to see if anybody's written about this. But I found something called Neglected Impeachment Intelligence on Biden, Burisma, Trump, and the Grigorians, and I have no idea what they are, by Leonard G. Horowitz and Sherry Kane. This is the part of simultaneous publication, The Frank Report, Judicial Corruption News. Never heard of that. Anyway, talk about an investigation, it says, by the LA Weekly. Let's see if I get your date on this. Yeah, I don't see a date. Can you guys see up with dates on your article so I can tell people when they're from? An investigation by the LA Weekly provides a glimpse into the neglected impeachment intelligence involving Hollywood producers of Lone Survivor. Stephen Marcherosian and his partner Remington Chase were convicted cocaine dealers with ties to the Russian oil mob and alleged contract murder. The hit was most likely ordered by Mikhail Gorodovsky, previously one of Russia's wealthiest oil tycoons, in prison for the alleged murder of a Siberian town mayor. Well, there's some intrigue for you. Siberia in the east to the Ukraine in the west both include parts of the Dnieper Donets Basin. This land affords the world's greatest hope for fuel from, here we go, abiotic oil. This is what attracted me to this article, right? So here we are. This is abiotic oil pops up again. The Dnieper Donets Basin, the Dnieper River is the one that runs through, you guessed it, Ukraine, okay? So this is from Ukraine to Siberia. There's the Dnieper Donets Basin, so they got all this oil. This huge amounts of oil. I'm just massive. It's probably trillions of barrels. Anyway, it says the 2003 arrest of Russia's Mikhail Gorodovsky of Yukos Oil took place just before he could sell a dominant stake in Yukos to ExxonMobil after Gorodovsky had a private meeting with Dick Cheney. This is revealed William F. William Engdahl for Canada's Global Research Group. Quote, had Exxon got the stake, they would have gotten control of the world's largest resource of geologists and engineers trained in the abiotic techniques of deep drilling. Okay. This is the big mystery. This is, you know, I think the most intriguing part of this. Okay. Is that what's going on with oil? I think there's a whole thing. Nobody's been talking about this, right? You know, you listen to the news and they all parrot the same stuff. Well, we have to save Ukraine and we have to do this and we have to do that. Even though, you know, the biggest problems of Ukraine are NATO and Brandon and his globalists and his, and all these other folks. But think about this for a second. Let me read that again. 2003 arrest of Russia's Mikhail Gorodovsky of Yukos Oil took place just before he could sell a dominant stake in Yukos to ExxonMobil. What does ExxonMobil want to do with this? All right. Do they want to lock up this oil? It's like the tobacco companies that bought all the trademark names for marijuana cigarettes, you know, because they didn't want anybody doing it.
or the suppression. Who's the, I'm trying to think of there's a company that has bought up all the patents, you know, for a particular technology, so it won't be released. And I forgot what it is, but you know, this happens all the time. The companies suppress the technology because they don't want the competition, right? So listen to this here, and this is Khodorkovsky had a private meeting with Dick Cheney. Well, what the hell, Dick Cheney? I got to follow up all these names, right? Revealed F. William Engdahl for Canada's global research group. Now, Canada's involved in this. Of course, Canada has the Keystone Pipeline, right? Had Exxon got the stake, they would have gotten control. Had Exxon got the stake, they would have gotten control of the world's largest resource of geologists and engineers trained in the abiotic techniques of deep drilling. Okay, so what that means is the greatest, largest resource of geologists and engineers, I guess they're Russian and Ukrainian, that know about how to find this oil that's deep down in the Earth's mantle. Because they're the only ones trained in it. We don't train in stuff here because we're still dealing with, quote, fossil fuels. That, as far as I'm concerned, is a minor part of oil, if any. All right. Then the article says the high-risk nations of Iran and Iraq are similarly intertwined. The Anglo-American oil giants have controlled global energy via Saudi Arabia and Kuwait and Nigeria as well. As the giant fuel fields began declining at the turn of the century, ExxonMobil et al. Recognized the dwindling oil fields of Iraq and Iran as the largest remaining base of cheap, easy oil. As China's and India's huge demand for oil grew, it became a geopolitical and national security imperative for the United States to impose military rule over those oil reserves. So there's one of the great unanswered questions for you, okay? What happened to all the Iranian, what happened to all the Iraqi oil? Well, I mean, they didn't burn it all off, you know. So is it still there? And who's controlling it? Remember, Trump kept saying they went to war with Iraq, but they didn't keep the oil. Okay, so this is getting more interesting all the time. So then we have George Bush's Vice President Cheney was chairman and CEO of Halliburton Company from 1995 to 2000 and retained stock in the company. Halliburton is the world's largest oil geophysical services company. The main threat to that control of oil was the Russian-Ukrainian energy giants. Now it's getting better. Okay. Now I'm really intrigued. So you got Halliburton and the globalists, you know, the Cheneys and the Bushes on one side. You've got the Russian and Ukraine oil giants on the other side. You've got Biden, you know, with Burisma, which is Ukrainian, you know, plus Hunter. You've got John Kerry. He's there. I think there's four people there. Pelosi's son, Kerry's son, Biden's son, and there's another one. There's Romney, Romney's kid. He's there, too. So all these kids are there, you know, and all of a sudden there's this war going on? For what? Is it an oil war? We just don't know about it? I don't know. I just find, like I say, I find this all quite fascinating. So here we go. More on this article here. So during the early 2000s, Dick Cheney's Halliburton Enterprise sought to control the technology to develop the Dnieper-Donets Basin. That's that huge oil reserve way underground, abiotic oil, incorporating Russia and much of the Ukraine. This country just keeps popping up again. Much like Vice President Biden did under the Obama administration to work a deal with his son Hunter to gain a piece of the oil action in the basin through Burisma, Vice President Cheney did similarly under the Bush administration with questionable success. So wait a minute. So Bush sent Cheney from Halliburton to Ukraine. Biden sends Hunter to Burisma in Ukraine. Ukraine keeps popping up. It just never ends, right? Article says Putin understandably opposed these Anglo-American efforts to control the mostly Russian landmass. To oppose the Western infringement, Putin caused his greatest and wealthiest critic, Khodorkovsky, to be arrested for fraud and tax evasion. Okay? So Putin has his enemy, to oppose Western infringement. Excuse me. So what if Ukraine's really about oil? What if the whole thing's about oil? It's always been about oil. That they want to safeguard the Dnieper-Donets Basin from companies like Halliburton and ExxonMobil and things like that. I don't know. This is a whole new branch of investigation. This is going to be fun. Then back to the article. Then after Khodorkovsky spent 10 years in jail, Putin inexplicably pardoned the oil tycoon in 2013. Putin's sudden leniency was perfectly timed to accommodate the Obama-Biden-Putin consortium's interest in piping fuel from the Siberian-Ukrainian Dnieper-Donets Basin to Germany, where Khodorkovsky immediately emigrated. Well, isn't that interesting? So there's your Nord Stream 2 pipeline, I'm guessing, right? So much of the partisan left's mantra that Trump, more than Obama, cowed down to Putin. Well, of course, we all know that was a bunch of nonsense. The last person Putin wanted was Trump. He obviously they're in business somehow with Brandon. and or brand. I don't know. It's we got to investigate. And then it says these facts best explain why Obama Secretary of State John Kerry welcomed Khodorkovsky's release, stating the United States strongly encourages Russia to pursue reforms that establish a transparent, independent, and reliable judicial system that upholds its commitments to human rights, the rule of law, and non-discrimination. Kerry neglected any mention of the Advancing Energy Alliance. It says in the LA Weekly, Remington Chase reported this history as an FBI informant, and Marchir Roshan informed authorities he would inform the CIA about his alleged involvement in the aforementioned contract killing and assorted intelligence. Aforementioned contract killing and assorted intelligence on these petroleum bosses. This is interesting. This is a different article, it looks like. It says, how and why the deep state controls Hawaii. It says, Hawaii is America's foremost strategic military outpost between East and West. The military occupation here was first used by organized crime to enrich the nation's opium traders. Then other drugs, human slaves, and sex traffickers enriched the enterprise. Money moved through local and multinational laundering banks and largely built the most powerful energy companies. This pattern and practice of syndicate and syndicate commerce was well established by the early 20th century. It especially enriched the Bronfmans, I don't know who they are, their bootlegging and black market operation fueled New York, Las Vegas, and Hollywood mobs from the family's Canadian distillery. Bronfman, oh, I've heard about them now. Yeah, isn't that Seagram's? Or Canadian, this one of the Canadian whiskeys? I think that's Seagram's. All right, here we go. So the Bronfmans relied on the Vanderbilt Railroads that were partnered with the Rockefeller Standard Oil Company, in other words, today's ExxonMobil, to move fuel. Consequently, the Bronfmans, Vanderbilts, and Rockefellers were partners in America's most powerful and lethal organized crime syndicate. This is great. The incomprehensible control over border insecurity and government corruption in Democrat-controlled Hawaii reflects this history. That's a different article. Well, there's more stuff going on here. Well, this is fascinating. Okay, so I don't know how much of this is true yet. I don't know where to go with this. but it seems to me, you know, neglected impeachment intelligence on the Biden-Burisma-Trump proceedings. What the hell is that all about? So I'm curious. You know, so like I said, we've got just a couple of minutes left here. But, yeah, I don't want to get started on another article. Go back to the source on this. So this is from my – I looked at Burisma and in abiotic oil. All right. So, oh, geez, we got more articles. This is going to be fun. So I'll trace this down later. I'll probably have something for you tomorrow. For also tomorrow, I've got more articles on this whole oil adventure. Well, let me just read this one quickly. I'll probably get through this one real fast. Oil is a renewable resource, and this is Russ McGlenn at Juno.com. And he wrote this in 2002. He says, oil. This is what we were talking about a little bit earlier. Oil wells in the Gulf of Mexico are being refilled with oil coming up from below the current oil fields. Russia has drilled over 300 8-mile-deep wells into the Earth's granite crust. This has worked so well that they worked in Vietnam and found oil off the coast where everyone said there was no oil. Oil used to be found in sedimentary rock at the 2 to 3 miles deep, but the Russians found a new source. What is happening? The Russians found that new oil is being made from hot molten rock called magma, heating the basement rocks of the Earth's crust. As the rocks are heated, methane gas is distilled. This combines with carbonates and carbon-14 that occur naturally in rock. When these are mixed together, they form oil. Okay, let me say that again. This combines, so you've got, as rocks are heated, methane gas is distilled. This combines with carbonates and carbon-14 that occur naturally in rock. When these rocks are mixed together, they form oil. It's called abiotic, non-biological, because it does not come from vegetable matter. Okay, the original theory of how oil was formed is that swamps filled with vegetation, biomass, were covered with mud, called sedimentary rock, once it hardened and decayed over a million years into coal or crude oil. This is called the biotic theory. All right, got a minute left. Let's see if I can do this. All right, oil is a renewable resource because it is being made today deep in the Earth's crust. We do not have an energy crisis; we have a leadership crisis. All right, one group says we're running out of energy, so that we have to cut back all that we do and will not allow us to drill for new oil. All right, this group says, we have plenty of new oil. All right, let's drill for it and use it. Says the writer, call your congressman and tell them your views. They're already feeling the heat from voters. Keep the pressure on. And they got an article on abiotic oil. So that's it. And that's just one of many. We're going to have more on this tomorrow. We're not done with this topic, even though I have about 20 seconds right now. But yeah. So those are things to think about, okay? All the Western land is that they say is federal is really state. CO2 is good for the environment, great for plants, and will help us out. And oil is a renewable resource. And if that doesn't cause you to think, tell all your friends. Tell them to listen to the show. See what they think. I've got the evidence. I just provided it. All right. Back tomorrow. Back tomorrow with another exciting show. This is Greg Penglis for Action Radio at blogtalkradio.com/citizenaction. Our legislative site is writeyourlaws.com, WRITEYOURLAWS. If you want to contribute, we've got givesendgo.com/actionradio. And, of course, if you're a company that wants to advertise, I'm happy to make any one of these wonderful productions for you. And you can help us out here. And like Sean Connery says in the movie First Night, there are laws that set men free. There are laws that enslave men, and there are laws that set them free. When we say here at Action Radio, we want to write the laws that set everybody free. See you tomorrow morning, 6 o'clock in the morning, Central Time.